I know I'm supposed to start at 1:10. Guess what? I'm starting at 1 o'clock. The only other witness is who? Is Kathy here? Osborne, step up, please. Pull over a chair here, please. Representative Minutes, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will restrain my comments for the record. My name is Representative Karen Minutes, House District 20, and I brought the Andersons here to testify, and I think I'll give my time to them and let them...
Thank you. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, my name is Mary Ann Anderson. I'm from Friday Harbor, Washington. I am a mother, a grandmother, and an early childhood educator. My background includes a master's in early childhood education, and I've worked with children the majority of my professional career. The story I'm about to tell you involves my family, child custody, and domestic violence. Our daughter lost custody of her 2-year-old baby girl. Even though she was found by the court to be the fit primary caregiver. Her husband was a spousal abuser and a traveling salesman. She was a stay-at-home mom and a wife. Testimony showed a preponderance of evidence that the father was an abuser. However, the judge who awarded the father sole custody of his daughter admitted that Oregon custody laws were not really a help to her, and that ORS 107.135 really allowed her to do anything she wanted to do in a custody ruling. In acknowledging the fact that the father was an abuser, she said, although the father is the epitome of an abuser, that still does not answer what is in the best interest of this child. Our daughter separated from her abusive husband 11 times in 6 years. The abuse began when she was kicked in the stomach twice when she was 14, was pregnant. I took her to the hospital and held my breath as the doctor at St. Vincent's searched for a heartbeat. She's been beaten with a golf club, thrown against a hot stove. She's been humiliated in front of her family and her friends. Twice when her husband was in a rage, he took the baby and vanished for the day. One of those days was Mother's Day. A psychological examination ordered by the child custody evaluator reported that, quote, the father's pattern is predictive of aggressive outbursts towards family members, in many cases choking and committing other assaults on wives and children, and that his hostility could suddenly be turned inward, resulting in a serious suicide attempt. His limited tolerance for frustration and painful dislike of rejection are apt to be central in these shifts of mood and eruptions of anger. A careful evaluation should be obtained of his alcohol and drug use. End of quote. Exposing children to violence of one parent against another parent is one of the most severe forms of psychological abuse that can occur. These children often experience severe psychological trauma, in part from the fear that a parent could be killed, or from guilt that they could not stop the violence, or that perhaps they may have caused that violence. This violence has a long-range impact on families and our society. Children from violent homes are likely to become the next generation of victims and perpetrators. The best predictor of future abusive behavior is past abusive behavior, and abuse does not end with divorce. This puts those children ordered by the court to live with their battered parent at daily risk. Judges are not immune from the myths and the misconceptions about domestic abuse, and when laws become ambiguous, the judge can compose the law any way he or she wants. Therefore, clear laws are necessary to mitigate judicial discretion in custody cases. In trying to reverse this judge's ruling in our daughter's custody fight, we have found that the state of Oregon has very little control over the discretionary powers of their judges. Very few family court cases requesting review at the Supreme Court level are accepted. The Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability dismisses 99% of all judicial complaints, and the appellate court usually defers to the trial judge's decision. Witnessing domestic violence is a terrifying experience with devastating consequences on our children. More birth defects are caused by domestic violence than all other accidents and illnesses combined. Most children who are subjected to domestic violence are high-need children. They are anxious and they're frightened, and they push buttons that reveal unpleasant scenes. A batter who cannot control his emotions and actions cannot meet the custodial needs of his child, no matter how much he loves her. Domestic violence is all about power and control, need and fear. It permeates every fiber of family life. It affects family ties, attitudes towards the perpetrator, the relationships within the extended family. But most importantly, domestic violence dramatically affects the way children perceive their world. When laws allow interpretation that gives batters custody of their children, then those laws are putting the individual rights of the batter over the rights of innocent children. Our family has paid a huge price for Oregon custody laws that remain vague and ambiguous, thereby allowing judicial discretion in determining what is in the best interest of the child. Our most precious resources are our children. They deserve far more protection than what current custody laws provide in the state of Oregon. I believe that Senate Bill 1075 provides that protection. Thank you for your time.
Janice, can I allow your written testimony to stand and speak for self?
Yes. Oh.
No. Would that be all right, acceptable or not, if you feel? So it's part of the record. We just do that. That you understand? I mean,
yes, that the written testimony
yes.
is part of the record. I understand.
So you, I was saying it has to not be at the end of the record. Is that okay with you, Mr. Anderson?
Right.
Is that all right? Kathy, could you just want to make a quick general statement? I realize you're neutral on the bill, but could you just give us a quick general statement as to where you are in the juvenile rights, since you represent the Juvenile Rights Project on this legislation?
Thank you, Chairman. For the record, my name is Kathy Osborne from the Juvenile Rights Project. We are neutral on the bill. We do have a couple of concerns, and the main concern is that there's no time period given for the crime that the parent who has committed the abuse will not be given custody. There's no time period there. We believe that the crafter should be a qualifier of if the parent has successfully completed counseling, that there's section that says that they are not allowed to have custody, or if the court's not allowed given even joint custody, should be considered. In juvenile court, we certainly encourage the parents that have committed abuse against their children to change their circumstances, get counseling so that they can become a fit parent for their child. If the child was perhaps an infant at the time that the domestic abuse happened, the abuser gets treatment, then 10, 15 years later, there's a divorce, And there has been no abuse in that 10 or 15 years. Certainly it seems to us that the court should be able to consider both parents as fit parents at that time, and the previous abuse that happened a long time ago and there has been no ongoing abuse should not be considered by the court. And that's just our concern.
Thank you. Also, thank you for your testimony. You came out from Washington, did you? Thank you very much for coming down today, and I hope you have a pleasant weekend. Thank you very much. The public hearing on Senate Bill 1075 is closed. We open the public hearing on Senate Bill 70. You have a list. Dave Sparks, please step forward. Senate Bill 70.
Good afternoon, Mr. Vice Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Sparks. I'm the Deputy Administrator for Oregon OSHA. I have provided some brief written testimony in support of Senate Bill 70, and I think that in deference to the time constraints you're operating under, I won't add any other comments except to say that we do support the proposal based upon our experience as it relates to our own enforcement officers in Oregon OSHA.
I could read this creates crime, assaulting public servant, intimidating public servant, and intimidating a judge. It's a Class C felony, punishable by a maximum of 5 years, $100,000 fine or both, increases penalty for harassing public servants, a maximum of 5 years imprisonment. Is that correct?
As I understand it, Mr. Vice Chairman, yes, sir.
Right. We do have a copy. Everyone should have a copy of the written statement by Mr. Sparks. Right here. It's part of the record. Thank you very much. I do not... All right, thank you. Scott, Trent.
Thank you, sir.
Trent Hampton, step up, please.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. I'm Scott Crampton from the Oregon Judicial Department. Briefly, I'd like to offer the Judicial Department's support for this bill, particularly the Judicial Conference Committee on Security and Hazardous Materials. It's an important bill for both the staff that work in the court, the jurors, and judicial officers.
Thank you very much. The public hearing on Senate Bill 70 is closed. Open the public hearing on Dave. Girls, is he here? All right. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 854. What do you got here for me on 854?
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. 854, you will find a -3 set of amendments in your packet. And what these amendments do relate to the issue of exempting lawyer legislators from CLE requirements for the Oregon State Bar, except for the ethics requirements. And that's something similar to what the state of Washington has.
Is there anyone here to testify on this bill? Since I don't have the sign-up sheet, please step forward.
The amendments are in lieu of the bill.
All right. This is the gotten stuff, a word we do not speak of until the last few weeks of the session, but we're now speaking of it. It's gotten stuff. Yes, please, since I don't know who you are.
Mr. Chairman,
I know who you are. Steve? Steve?
That's correct. Steve's here.
All right, Steve, please.
Mr. Chairman, Steve's here. I'm here representing the Oregon State Bar Minimum Continuing Legal Education Board. The board is generally opposed to Amendment Number 3 as a result of three different factors. The first is a separation of powers issue as to whether or not this should properly be something considered by the Supreme Court rather than the legislature. The second is a fear by the board that this bill would open the door to more and more exemptions until the exemptions eventually swallow the rule, as has largely happened in California. And third, that the purpose of MCLE and the only justification for its existence is to protect the public from lawyers who are not competent because they have not kept current in the areas that they practice. The board has taken this position not lightly. We have considered the issue several times, and the board is considering alternatives, one of which would be to put all legislator lawyers on even-year reporting periods. The second would be to create a credit or exemption, more likely a credit for legislative training for freshman legislators so that that activity would qualify for the credit. That would require a rule change. I can also relate that the vote on this issue by the board will probably be taken at the board meeting tomorrow. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I'll be sure to let the chair of the committee, the 25-year veteran of private practice, as well as myself as an attorney, how you know how you feel about this.
Can I ask you a question?
You may, please.
Mr. Chair, isn't it true that the Board of Bar Governors of the Oregon State Bar have recommended that lawyer legislators receive some kind of recognition of their service through CLE credits because they figure that the information they listen to here on a day-by-day basis during session is significant?
The Board of Governors has recommended that credit be given to legislators on some sort of a pro rata basis. That is correct. That is not the position, though, of the MCLE board. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony. Anybody else want to speak on Senate Bill 854? Public hearing is closed. Senate Bill 917, open public hearing. Michael Tate, Gary Harkins, and I want Dave Cook up here. He's not signed up, but I want him up here just to make him feel real uncomfortable. Yeah, I bet you do. Yes, I am making my own agenda. You're correct. Now, let me see my list again. I just gave it away. What happened to my sign up sheet on this?
I'm just
917. I just gave it back. Oh. All right, Gary, you go first because you're for the. It's your bill, right?
Yes.
All right. Now remember, you don't take long. You just tell me why you need this protection that the head of corrections doesn't want you to have and the head of the prison industry program doesn't want you to have. Go ahead, please.
Chairman Courtney, members of the committee, my name is Gary Harkins, and I'm a sergeant of defense, and I'm also president of the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. We believe this bill is necessary because we have non-CO staff and contract staff supervising inmates in the community with as little as 2 hours of training. That training was received by video. This was particularly brought out here recently when they made the decision to switch corrections officers on laundry trucks over to non-CO drivers. Many of those drivers were working in the community supervising inmates for 3 months with as little as 2 hours of training. We believe that DOC should conform to Department of Public Safety and Standards and Training's definition of a corrections officer, which says that anyone who has control, custody or supervision of an inmate is by definition a corrections officer, and we feel that those people should be trained to the level of a corrections officer. And that's it in a nutshell.
Thank you, Gary. And now we have a written statement by you, Mr. Tate, in opposition. Please put some testimony in the record, but please don't read this very nice statement, which is part of the record. I also have written the name Dave Cook in red ink, who is the head of Department of Corrections, noting that he is also against the bill. So, Mr. Tate, would you proceed, please?
Senator Courtney, members of the committee, my name is Michael Tate. I'm the administrator of the Inmate Work Program for the Department of Corrections, and I'm speaking here on behalf of the department this afternoon. The safety and security of Oregon communities is of utmost importance to the Department of Corrections, and the provisions of this bill would make it difficult to successfully deploy inmate work crews, as well as increase the cost to other governments for the use of those crews. We believe that appropriate training is provided in ORS 421-445 currently, and that provisions of the bill that ask that state employees working with inmates be told what the nature of their crimes are is unnecessary, and that knowledge is of no significance in the effective performance of their duties. And I guess in summary, then, the department opposes this, believes that the current statute, again, ORS 421-445, already provides sufficient protection for state employees working with inmates.
Thank you. Mr. Cook, do you have any remarks to make?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that Mr. Tate has covered it. These are minimum custody inmates. They are within 3 years of release. We have a long history of having other than DOC employees with security backgrounds doing supervision of these inmates. The laundry truck example, although a very graphic example of a poorly done job of training on our behalf, is not the norm. It is not the standard that we train to. I don't think that pricing the inmate work product out of the means of local communities to purchase that is appropriate, simply because we do not have a history that shows that this is necessary.
Thank you. I don't know if it's possible, but you two at least have a conversation and see if there's something you can work out. Maybe you can. If you can't, you can't. But I hope that you just don't walk away and never speak to each other again.
Mr. Chair, we speak all the time, and we just are in disagreement about whether COs need to be the level trained.
We've had discussions on this.
Well, what I'm saying to you is I want you to have more discussions.
Yes,
and then, I'm inviting you to have more discussions. If you can't get there, you can't get there. So could you do that, please?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Excuse me.
Here.
Senator Toronto, yes?
Just very quickly, what's happened to bring this bill forward?
Senator Toronto, I don't quite understand the question.
Well, we've got a bill in front of us. What caused this bill to be here?
Okay, the bill is here because we believe the safety of the public is at risk. You have staff supervising inmates out there with no training. They're not. They have been told by the director and the assistant directors not to respond if an inmate attacks a civilian. They are to call 911. They're not to get involved. Sure.
I mean, has there been actual assaults taking place?
We've had numerous incidents. We had one at Fairview here this last month this last December, where an inmate was found kissing an employee of Fairview. The non-CO driver had let the inmate slip away. He was found by a corrections officer engaged in misconduct. We have many instances of large amounts of contraband being found in the work areas where these inmates are found. Contraband gets back to the institutions, creates a dangerous situation inside the institutions. We feel that if these people were trained in security issues, the amount of contraband would be greatly reduced.
Well, Mr. Chair, when inmates come back in the institution, don't they go through a shakedown process?
They do go through a shakedown process, Senator Turner, but they do have a tendency to swallow things at times, so those types of things are not found when they're brought in.
Okay, gotcha.
Thank you very much for coming and testifying. Can we call the chair 917? Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 975. James Rice, step forward, please. James Rice, there you go. Senator Corcoran, I guess, also, is this his bill? Is Senator Corcoran here? I guess I signed on to it, too, because that doesn't, you never know what I'm doing. Mr. Rice, please.
All right, Chair Courtney.
75. You're against it.
I'm against it, and my concern is in Section 1 about not disclosing any information about an individual involved.
I got to do this. Prohibits public body from disclosing information about undercover employee of criminal justice agency, creates action for damages for disclosure, requires public body to notify employee of criminal justice agency of request to inspect records about employees, prohibits disclosure of information about employee of criminal justice agency without court order or failure to report or object, limits award of attorney fees to petitioner in action to compel disclosure information about employees of criminal justice agency, exempt from disclosure photograph of a public employee and information about personal investigation that does not result in discipline. The reason I did that is, it's sort of weird to have somebody start out against the bill as opposed to somebody else start for the bill. That's the reason I did that. Sorry I interrupt you, Mr. Rice. I need to do that. So please proceed now with your testimony.
Thank you, Senator Courtney. No problem at all. Perhaps there's no one for the bill because they've seen a problem with the bill.
I signed on the bill. That's not a good way to begin.
I'm trying to be funny, and it's not working, Senator. I'll get right to the quick of it here. Brady versus Maryland is something that every criminal defense lawyer is concerned with, and of course is the representative of OCDLA. I'm just simply pointing out the fact that any exculpatory evidence the accused is entitled to, and there's a process here that involves court orders. It seems what we're doing is unnecessarily burdening the discovery process, which is normally quite informal between district attorneys and defense lawyers, and judges don't get involved in it. It's a time-consuming process. There are times when judicial orders are involved in the process, but I simply point out the kind of an impediment that this is going to present to the everyday practitioner and add cost and expense to the system that we're trying to be efficient with in today's practice.
Written testimony or anything?
No,
that's okay.
I don't.
That's fine. Questions for the comments on this? Yes, Senator Brown.
Brady versus Maryland, is that a...
It's a United States Supreme Court opinion.
Since you said Maryland, I'm thinking, oh, yeah, this has got to be United
States. And it's a fundamental principle that the accused is entitled to exculpatory information. The state has a burden to provide that to the defense lawyer. And I just see this as, it's a problem. Yes, we can go around it. We can go to the judge. We can hold hearings. It's difficult to get those kinds of hearings, and it's a time-consuming process. And looking at the benefit versus the detriment of the bill, I'm opposed to it.
Thank you.
Anything further? Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Anyone else sign up on that bill?
No. Close the public hearing on Bill 975. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 983. Let me see. We have Michael Dole. Hale? Dave Neville?
Neville.
Step forward, please. And wait a minute. Yeah, 983.
Is Senator Castillo going to come testify?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Neville. I'm actually appearing for Michael Dale here, who is in another committee hearing on a related issue, and I believe that Senator Castillo is also involved in that hearing in the Senate Committee on Business Affairs. I'm here to speak. I work for the Oregon Law Center, and I'm here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 983, which would strengthen existing protections against retaliation and employment. Under existing law, discrimination against workers who complain about illegal working conditions is illegal. This would simply improve the remedies available to workers now. This is especially important to farm workers who know that if they lose their job, they're also likely to lose their housing. And also, there's a possibility that they might be blacklisted as a troublemaker if and when they attempt to find other employment in agriculture. If I might give a short example, there's a woman who was employed as a farm worker in the Salem area here in an onion packing house. She was employed for 7 years. She put up with inadequate toilet facilities for 7 years. There wasn't a men's and women's toilet. It was always filthy. Workers had to bring their own toilet paper. There wasn't safe drinking water. And finally, she complained to the employer about this, and she wasn't rehired. She wasn't rehired during the next season. And she made a complaint to the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and the employer initially told her she wasn't being rehired because she had a fight with another worker, and that worker was named. Well, it turned out that a worker by that name had never worked for this employer. Then the employer said that she had refused to work overtime, which was true, but the reason that she refused to work overtime was that she was pregnant and it was against doctor's orders. And finally, the employer said that she wasn't a good worker, that she let too many substandard onions through, that she'd been used as a trainer by that employer while she was on the job. And so none of these excuses really held water. Even if she wins her case, even if that worker won her case, all she would be entitled to would be the wages that she would have earned if she hadn't spoken up. And she would also be entitled to reinstatement. But two things about this. One, the wages for a short period of employment like this don't amount to much. And also, reinstatement is not a real meaningful issue when the employment is probably over by the time the decision comes down. So it's no wonder that employees opt not to make complaints when the remedies are so inadequate. So what 983 does is a couple of things. One, it would require, upon request by the employee, an employer to specify a reason why the employer was discharged. And of course, that will employees may just be discharged for no reason, and that could be what the employer says. Second, it would allow workers a meaningful remedy for retaliation where the worker is not reinstated. And the remedy would be a damages remedy, and the amount of damages would be set based basically on how egregious the employer's conduct was, the length of the prior employment, the size and sophistication of the employer, and the need to deter retaliation and mitigating factors offered by the employer. The bill would establish burdens of proof to assist the court in reaching a fair determination of whether retaliation actually occurred or whether the employer acted for other reasons. And finally, existing prohibitions on retaliation would be made a little clearer so that if an employee took steps toward making a complaint, like discussing the problem with the employer, but the employer discharges the employee before the complaint is actually made, the employee would still be protected. So that, in a nutshell, is what this bill amounts to. We would urge you to pass this bill.
Thank you. A question for Mr. Dale, please?
Yes. Actually, I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, I'm David Niebel.
Sorry, David. Sorry. Okay, David. Senator Humphrey.
David, on page 2, down to section 5. Where did the figures less than 480 times and no more than 7,200 times come from?
That is equal to from between 2 to 30 months of employment. That's the range.
But I mean, Mr. Chair, I mean, is that same kind of formula being used in other states that we're aware of?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carno, I do not know. I can try to find that out.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Brown, sure.
This bill would not apply to just farm workers. It would apply to all employees, correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, that's correct.
And my concern would be that having to give a reason for being let go or being fired, whatever you call it, do you see it as being somewhat burdensome to the employer?
It would only be upon request of the employee that be done.
Okay.
Other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Anyone else here for 983? Close the public hearing at 983. Anyone here for 996? About 12:15. Anybody here for 12:15? Can I go 12:15? We're getting ahead. I may have to. Yes, sir.
Isn't Senator Shannon going to come talk to Brian 12:15?
No.
Yes, she is.
There she is.
All right. So, Shannon, step forward, please. I'm saying you're here for 12:15.
Okay.
Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 12:15. So, Shannon, please.
Yes. Chair Courtney and the rest of the members, this bill comes before you today because, and I don't know if Senator Brown up there disagrees or what, but I personally do not believe that no-fault divorce has really helped women that much. There are some women, in fact, that tell me that it has hurt them. And what this bill would do is give people the choice when they get married, to choose to have a covenant marriage. In a covenant marriage, you agree to go through premarital counseling, and then if you decide to get divorced, you have to have counseling to show what divorce does to children, to show how it impacts their lives for a long time and how you can deal best with the children, focuses on the children. And it's not a mandate. It just says that if you want to go into a more strict relationship to get in and out of, then you would choose a covenant marriage. And it's totally by choice.
Okay.
And it doesn't have to be counseled by the church. You can have, you know, public counseling. Yes.
I do have a question in terms of practicalities. And it provides in the bill that the party shall receive counseling prior to the marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something they would pay for on their own, or is that something that the state would provide?
No, they would pay for it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Other questions, Senator Shannon?
Mr. Chair, one more question. It's my understanding that Louisiana has introduced this.
They passed it.
And I'm curious if you've had any reports as to whether it was successful and if there's been a lot of people that sign up for it or anything.
I don't.
Okay.
And as a matter of fact, I really do believe that when we change our laws to something new, like education, marriage, all this, that there should be a cause, it should have a record of success someplace, and I do believe that, not to weaken me, but I would have a stronger case if I had the statistics from Louisiana that said divorce rates went down, and et cetera, because I do believe in a record of success. It's a good background to change the law, that it works.
Good, Donna? Everett? Are in high councils?
Well, I think Senator Starr is going to show up at Tinder. We thought this was time certain.
Well,
so
I
hear you've been moving through.
Yeah, that's right. I believe in efficiency.
I know you
and
do.
I
know
in
you
punctuality.
Do. And we do not believe in wasting words.
That's correct.
I've learned that.
And you should be happy as soon as you walk in here that you were noticed and brought forward. So you should be grateful that we did this.
I'm grateful.
Starr's here. That's unfortunate for him.
I'm grateful for all the kindness that you show your colleagues.
That's right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Brown.
Well, while we have this interesting issue before us, have you talked to any family law attorneys about this?
There was one.
Mm-hmm. Pardon?
One.
Okay, and I was curious as to what kind of feedback you get, because it's I used to practice family law, and I think I came in the mid-80s, so probably after about 15 years that we've had no-fault divorce, and I think the complaints that I heard from folks who used to do fault divorce is that it's a real pain, you know. Parties got to hire investigators, they got to be able to prove that there's adultery going on and all
that
kind of stuff. And so I'm just curious if you'd talk to anybody doing divorce law and what their thoughts were.
That's exactly what they said, that sometimes that it gets messy like that. But the point of it, this is not mandatory to anybody. This is something they know that going into it, that it's going to be that the marriage that they choose is a little bit more difficult to get out of. They're fully aware of the law, what they're doing to themselves. And so I hope eventually that we do it. I realize this is just hearings today. But do you have any questions, Senator Courtney?
I do not, Senator Shannon.
You must support my bill. Then, that's a question. Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to come before you.
Thank you, Senator Shannon. Okay. Have a nice, have a good time. Thank you very much. Close. Thank you. Close the hearing on 12:15. I'm going to open one on Senate Bill 1292 because we've got 400 people signed up. Andy, James, Dave, Kingsley Click, all come forward, please.
Mr. Chair, well, they're coming up.
Yes, please.
What was the process for getting work sessions on some of these bills?
The process is the following. The chair and the vice chair are supposed to meet after today and have a discussion. And that's how I left it. However, yesterday told me you wanted my views and things, but is there another thing you'd like? Would you like another process? Or?
No, I just was very much intrigued by 1215.
Oh, okay. I don't quite know how to read that, but that's okay. Excuse me. You want to talk to me now?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, go ahead.
I got out there, I realized I had all the statistics about Louisiana, the improvement.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Okay. Andy, you want to go first here?
Thank you, sir. I'm Andy, Deputy Public Defender Andy Simran. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association and on my own behalf as a taxpayer and citizen of the state of Oregon. My law practice is limited to criminal appeals, and I'll candidly say that although I think I'm pretty good at what I do, I lose the great majority of my cases. That will change unless you pass this bill. There is a long line of cases in the federal courts and in the state courts that discuss the prejudice to an accused defendant who is restrained during trial. And I'd like to share with you a few words from the various courts. From the United States Supreme Court, a person accused of a crime is entitled to have his guilt or innocence determined solely on the basis of the evidence introduced at trial. From that, a federal circuit court has gone on to observe that it necessarily follows that a criminal defendant is generally entitled to the physical indicia of innocence. And more to the point, let me share with you what our own appellate court has said on the subject of restraining a defendant during trial, that the prejudice to a defendant shackled or otherwise physically restrained during trial is manifest. Other than the imposition of the death penalty, there can be no greater restraint imposed upon a citizen of the state of Oregon than imprisonment. And if shackling a defendant during trial is presumptively prejudicial and requires reversal of the conviction, then most certainly a trial conducted in the restraining atmosphere of within a correctional facility will certainly be reversed, either by the appellate courts of this state or by the federal courts. I have absolutely no doubt that if I see this issue come up during one of my cases, I'm going to begin chomping at the bit because I know I'm going to win this case. I think that all or most of the convictions that are ever obtained in criminal trials that are conducted within the confines of correctional institutions will be reversed. The citizens of this state have a profound interest in maintaining convictions in criminal cases that are otherwise fair. Rather than undermining this profound interest, convictions that are obtained in otherwise fair trials should be maintained by the passage of this important legislation, which will prevent the unnecessary reversal of untold convictions. That's really all I have to say, other than the fact that there is one other point I'd like to make. There is already litigation currently underway in the federal court system to enjoin this sort of trial. Obviously, the passage of this bill would render that litigation unnecessary. Thank you.
James Rice. James Rice, President of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Holding trials in prisons is not a new idea. The former Soviet Union employed that. But when I take a look at the Oregon Constitution, I read Section 11. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall have the right to public trial. Claiming that trials in the confines of a prison are public is a perversion of the language of the Oregon Constitution. It's unconstitutional. There are additional concerns: safety of jurors within prisons, jurors and trial court employees having no choice but to work inside prisons. This experiment attempting to provide savings at the cost of security is really kind of speculative. The way the trials are being, there's been one trial that's been held. It's held at 2 days a week. There are long delays between the witnesses testifying. There are eligibility requirements. Not everybody gets to go into the prison system for good reasons, and jurors are going to be excluded from serving on juries. I wrote a little article about this, and I said, well, for starters, if you think watching a video of a trial is the same as being there, I'd suggest having a video dinner sometime. It really isn't the same thing. I've been to prisons. I think prisons are pretty scary places. When that door shuts behind me, I don't have a calm feeling when I'm in there, and they're not intended to be calm places. Trials are supposed to be decided in a calm and deliberate manner. And there's an inherent conflict factually by having a trial in prison. Lastly, if we can't rely on the words in the Oregon Constitution, a right to a public trial, we can't rely on anything that's in the Constitution at all. This kind of legislation is preventing the Department of Corrections from holding unconstitutional trials, and it's preserving the words to mean what they say in the Oregon Constitution. If public trial doesn't mean in a public place, I think we've cut the clapper out of the bell of freedom.
Ed Cook.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dave Cook, Director of the Department of Corrections. I didn't realize the Department of Corrections was holding trials. This is held by the Malheur County Court at one institution, Snake River, at this point. I would argue that security in some of the nation's courtrooms are less secure than any security being offered in Oregon State prisons at this point. I do believe that Mr. Rice may have a point relative to public trials. That's something for the attorneys to debate. I don't think I want to get involved in that. But there are sufficient benefits, both in terms of cost savings and security, to warrant this. It may be that as the first trial has come and gone, there needs to be some work done to ensure that jurors are delivered to the court in a more timely fashion, other issues that may be important. But on the whole, we do not support the bill, do not believe it is necessary, and I think that there is a current model in Marion County. There are other attempts at doing this. I do not believe that the bill is something we can support, and I believe that the process, at least at Snake River, needs a chance for the model to continue to occur and measure its success after some period of time other than one trial.
Kingsley Quick.
Thank you. For the record, Kingsley Quick, State Court Administrator. We also feel like the bill is unnecessary at this time. The issues, as the defense bar has brought up, are on appeal right now. A number of things were put on the record. It was a carefully planned event, and with the advent of technology into our future and in courtroom settings as well as rest of everyday life, it's an important issue to work through, and I think the courts are the proper place to determine what's constitutional or not. Under that, I did provide you with a letter. I took off the covered the name of to whom it went because that wasn't part of what you needed to know, but you're welcome to that information as well. But the letter really sets out a response to some letters the Chief Justice received about raising concern on that trial. I just wanted to highlight a couple of items in it. The jury trial involved an altercation that occurred within the institution among inmates. The defendant was an inmate. All witnesses except the state police investigator were inmates, correctional officers, and employees of the institution. There was video transmission to the Malheur Circuit Court courtroom for any public members to watch. So it was not held in secret. The building itself was constructed with the idea of having trials in there and was able to accommodate jury trials as well. And I think that in this case, they went through juror orientation, asking the jurors about comfort levels. There were specific arrangements made to make sure, at least as best they could from their end, that this was not either a security issue for them or undue hardship. And as far as the legal issues raised, I think it's more properly left to be determined in the court. And as they began, I think at this point it's unnecessary legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. I also received a call from Judge Frank Gerlagen from a meeting in Eugene. Was so concerned about the bill he wouldn't drive up. He told me he didn't need to drive up. He's very much in opposition to this bill, so just want to put that on the record. He's, I guess, from Bale, Oregon, so that needs someone to put that on the record. Questions, comments for the witnesses, please? Yes, Senator Burris.
On the issue of the public trial, if somebody wanted to come to one of the trials in the Eastern Oregon prison, what would the Corrections Department response be if they wanted to attend personally?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I don't know. I have not experienced that situation to date, but the trial area, the courtroom itself, is in the visitor center, which is open to the public, at least on the visiting side for inmate purposes. I have not been faced with that, and I don't know whether we've written any rules around attendance by the public, which is the reason for video transmission, live transmission, so that people can watch it at the courthouse in Vail. If we had the necessity of that, we'd certainly work on the issue. If we're allowing jurors in there and others, as long as they've gone through the security measures present, I don't know that we would prohibit the public, but we, as I say, we've not been faced with it.
Did either of you have comments on that point?
I have been to the Vail Courthouse, but I've not seen this room. This is how I had it described to me. Someone wanted to watch the trial There's a small room. The door's locked. Someone got to go in and watch it, and a court employee watched the person watching the trial. There is no, if you've been in a courtroom, you see the dynamic, you size people up. People perceive things visually. They perceive them by being there. You can't get that off video. It really is a throwback to the Soviet Union. It's a throwback to holding trials in prisons. I mean, it's about government accountability is what the public trial is about in the United States Constitution and in Oregon's Constitution as well. And it can't happen the way it's being set up. A cleverly crafted plan seems to have been implemented because these court facilities were built into the prisons. And I had never heard of such a thing. No one I know of, I'm not privy to what the Department of Corrections knows, had heard of this process. There was no open debate before they built them.
Bill Taylor, Learned High Counsel.
Councilmember Chair, Mr. Rice, I do understand that Lane County does do arraignments inside the county jail. Is that correct?
And that's correct. Where someone can appear and someone, excuse me, they don't do that. They're in Clackamas County, though, where someone can simply come in and say, I plead guilty, I plead not guilty, whatever it is, and that is really not the equivalent to having a trial itself. In Lane County, they opposed video trials, video arraignments, and they have not employed them.
But don't they bring a judge into the Lane County Jail to take pleas?
They do. We have a courtroom there. There are no trials there. We do arraignments there. We also do changes of pleas there, and occasionally there is a sentencing there. What we've got here is Section 2 says a jury trial may not be held in the premises of the Department of Corrections. And there's a distinction there between the county jails, where there are some minimal judicial proceedings that are held that are not the equivalent of a jury trial.
Sure. Ms. Cliff, do you know of any other state in the union that holds jury trials within correctional institutions?
Chair Courtney, County Council, I have not inquired because it hasn't been asked of me. So, but I do know that we have a number of annexes around the state that have jail facilities in them, and we do hold court hearings in them, including in Marion County here.
Other questions concerning Senator Tarnow? Senator Brown? Senator Cuto? You're civil. Can't get on this. All right. Thank you very much for coming here today and testifying.
Thank you.
Thank you. We had a good show that time. All right, I'm going to go back because we've moved so quickly and people are not used to punctuality here. And we opened the public hearing on Senate Bill 917 for a less than a statement from Mary Boston, which means I get back to him too. He folks show up late to the.
Mr. Chair,
have you ever heard of the movie Speed?
I've never had judiciary move this quickly that the 2 o'clock time was so surpassed. Quickly.
No, wait a minute. You're not. Wait a minute. What bill are you on?
917.
917. 917.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Botkin. I'm here today representing the American Federation of State County Municipal Employees, who represent corrections officers, security, and non-security DOC staff, as well as folks working in the community who are being increasingly called upon to supervise inmate work crews. And we have a very serious concern that the staff training that non-security and non-DOC personnel are receiving is inadequate to protect the security and the sanctity of our institutions, placing those folks who work inside the institutions at risk, as well as placing folks who are supervising them at risk. We have been told of a woman in Baker City who was hired by the state of Oregon to be a forest ranger. She and a young intern from the community college there now work together in the forest or up in the state parks up out of Baker City. She was told by the head of the Parks Department that she would be supervising a 15 to a 20-man work crew. She indicated she was concerned that she didn't really want to do that, and she was told she could find other work then. And so she went through the security training, the 8 hours of security training, and as she imparted with me, to me, was most of the time was spent talking about the inmates' rights. She was not trained in self-defense mechanisms, nor in kind of basic security about what to do if there's a problem. And, I mean, she and I had a very friendly exchange. She is not one of my members, by the way. And she said, well, I don't know exactly what I'm supposed to do if there's a problem. I said, give them the keys and tell them to go away. You know, I mean, I don't know what you tell somebody in that situation if they're in a rural, isolated area and they have not had, and nor do they have quick security backup available to them. And this is becoming an increasing problem. And I understand that Mr. Cook, the head of the department, believes this to be a budget issue, and I sympathize with him completely. But we see this as a security issue, a public safety issue. We see it as a safety and health issue for our officers, for other state employees and public employees being asked to supervise these folks. And Senator Courtney, I appreciate your introducing this bill on our behalf. I know that Senator George shares your concern. He has a companion bill very similar to yours. He introduced it last session and has reintroduced it this session, and we would be supporting his bill as well, and would encourage you and Senator George to combine the two bills and be co-chief sponsors on one bill. I think this is very, very, very important. It is about the integrity and the accountability of inmate work crews outside of a secure perimeter. Folks who were considered medium security 10 years ago are now considered minimum security. I mean, this is about who we have in prison. And anybody who works in law enforcement knows that people today are much more violent than they were 10 years ago. And I just don't think we can afford to put people outside of the secure perimeter of an institution without appropriate security level staffing. And if we're not going to use highly trained security staff, if that's the problem, if that's the budget issue, then we've got to train folks so that they're better, so that they get better training. You know, we have suggested that we do some kind of a reduced BPSST certification. That somehow we find the way to do this. And I'm not sure how we get there, but I'm prepared to fight like the devil to get the budget to a level that allows us to provide the kind of security we think we need, to provide the work programs that we think we need, and that the Constitution requires now, and at the same time keep the community and our employees safe.
Questions? Judge Arnold.
No, yeah, the documented cases where we have problems with, besides the ladies you referred to, other documented cases.
We have stories. I think that if this woman wasn't so far away, we'd bring her over. I mean, it's just, I know you know how far Baker City is. I mean, it requires that we take her off work for a couple of days. And if it would make a difference, we would bring her over here to talk to each one of you personally. And we would pay her to do that. I mean, we would pay her lots of time to do that.
Senator Carnell, Brian DeWise, representing AOCE. If you'll review Gary Harkin's testimony, there are several incidents in there. He submitted written testimony. You should have it.
I went over Mr. Harkin's testimony. I think there's a number of incidences where non-security staff has been injured and placed at risk because of a lack of security personnel. I agree with Mr. Harkin that our kitchen staff and our food service staff is being placed at risk by not having security backup in the area. You know, and I just need to be real clear. I am not being particularly critical of the department. I think this department has been understaffed and underfunded and asked to do more with less for so long that they're doing the best they can. And And, you know, I mean, I'm going to be down the budget committee every day trying to get them what I think, what we think they need. But right now, we don't have it. And until we do, you all need to understand what the risks are that are involved in the practices that we're participating in.
Thank you for your testimony. Close
Thank
the hearing
you,
on 9/17. We open the hearing 9/75. Brian, you want to come up and make a statement?
Sir, for the record, Brian DeLeisland, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations. I'll be extremely brief. This bill is an important bill for the Oregon Council of Police Associations. I will be meeting with you. I'll attempt to set up some hearing or some meetings at a later date to explain the specific problem. But the problem we have, one particular case that I just want to mention that I'm aware of, and I was talking to the attorney this morning, there's been others, is a police officer in Portland who has gotten off his shift, gives another person a ride. This is a person that he was acquainted with, happened to be a prostitute. The prostitute was not in violation of anything. The police officer was not in violation of anything. But what happens is somebody tells the press that a police officer gave a prostitute a ride home after their, after his shift. A day later, the press has a picture of the police officer and a story talking about a police officer giving a prostitute a ride home. And where did they get the information? They got it directly from the files of the city. They went and asked for this officer's files, including a picture, and they were given all the information on this officer. We also have a problem, as the first section is, dealing with undercover officers. So it's a problem with whether or not the officer has the opportunity, once notified, that somebody's inquiring about their file, and can say, whoa, wait a minute, let's talk about this, let's have a hearing over this, before a jurisdiction just says, oh, yeah, sure, media, we'll get along with you, we'll give you the file, and you can read anything you want in the file. So that's, in essence, what the bill is all about. Thank you very much.
Questions, Brian?
Good bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. What is public hearing 975? Anybody here on 996 yet? Anything 996? All right, let's go to Senate Bill 1283.
Mr. Chair, members.
Ms. Crawford, please come forward.
Senate Bill 1283 members would require the Office of Medical Assistance Programs within the Department of Human Resources to provide an impartial grievance procedure and contracts for services, procedure that enrollees or subcontractors can use to seek resolutions of disputes. It was introduced by Senator Shearer.
And the request of the former State Representative Lonnie
Roberts.
Please proceed. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Hirsch Crawford, Director of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. And what I would like to do with respect to Senate Bill 1283 is just provide a little information and some clarification about what we do now, and indicate that if it would be easier for us to assess the impact of the bill if some of the terms in the bill were, we could get some clarification on those. As was indicated earlier, what the bill does is require that we implement an impartial grievance procedure for enrollees and subcontractors with managed care plans. Our assumptions in looking at the bill are, first, that the bill applies only to physical health care plans, dental care plans, and chemical dependency organizations who contract directly with OMAP. It would not apply to managed mental health care organizations because their contracts are with the Mental Health Division and not with OMAP. We currently do have in place several grievance and hearing options that are available for subcontractors and enrollees. For an enrollee who has a problem with a managed health care plan, he or she may request a grievance proceeding with the plan. If they're not happy with the result of the first grievance proceedings, they can request that it be reconsidered. And if they're still unhappy with that result, they can ask for a fair hearing, which is a process that's conducted by a hearings officer who's with the Adult and Family Services Division. Now, enrollees do not have to go through the grievance process first before asking for a fair hearing. They can skip the grievance process, go through the fair hearing process if that's what they would like to do, or they can go through both processes simultaneously. And then if they're not happy with the result of the fair hearing process, that can then be appealed to the Court of Appeals. In terms of subcontractors, there are also somewhat similar grievance
processes that are currently available to them. Any subcontractor who contests a decision that is made by a managed care organization resulting from decisions which have been made by the Office of Medical Assistance Programs or the Department of Human Resources can request either an administrative review or a fair hearing, and then has access to judicial review following the results of that process if they are dissatisfied with the results. However, the items that are subject to that appeal process are limited, and they're the following types of decisions. A denial or limitation of payment of services or items provided, denial of application for participation in medical assistance programs, sanctions imposed or intended to be imposed, or overpayment determinations. Now, that clearly doesn't encompass all of the issues that a subcontractor might have with a contractor. And if the intent of the bill is to have a more inclusive process than we currently have, then we would be required to modify our rule structure in order to accomplish that. In looking at the bill, there are several issues which we would like some clarification or some direction on in terms of trying to assess the impact. On page 2, lines 8 and 9 of the bill, where it says the Office of Medical Assistance Program shall provide for an impartial grievance procedure, does that mean that we would need to ensure that that such a procedure is established, perhaps in contract, or does it mean that we must participate in the procedure and conduct it? We believe that the current dispute resolution process, which both enrollees and subcontractors have access to, is impartial. If that doesn't satisfy the intent of the bill, then it's not clear to us exactly what an impartial process would be. The last issue that we would like some clarification on is the term dispute, which is used in the bill. If in fact that can be read very broadly, and we question whether or not it's really the intent of the bill or the expectation to have the state, for instance, involved in disputes about payment rates between a managed care plan and a subcontractor, which, if the term dispute is read very broadly, certainly would encompass that. So, Mr. Chair, we're neutral on the bill. We could better assess the fiscal impact if there was some clarification of some of the terms that are in the bill.
Have you talked to Senator Shannon or former Representative Lonnie Roberts about this, Chair?
Mr. Chair, I have not.
Okay. Questions? Concerns?
Thank you.
Yes, Senator.
Chair?
No?
I'll just ask later.
Okay.
Later.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Of course, we can probably chair the bill 12-8. Let's see, those people get in. Let's go to open public hearing on 844. Do you want to make a statement on that? Well, I'll make a statement. I was asked by the principal at North Carolina High School to create a school safety zone piece of legislation because he had situations that he had a sex offender in the hallways, and he had gangbangers in the hallways, and he could trespass them, which means you could throw them out of the building, North Carolina High School, and then they could go and stand in the sidewalks right immediately to the front door in the surrounding area, which he would like them not to be able to do. I'd like to move them further away from the entrance to North Carolina High School. I understood he told me there was a bill in Georgia, legislation in Georgia, which allowed for that. Surely there is, and he found it. But it was the legislative council's opinion that the bill in Georgia is basically unconstitutional. So I think the number -1 amendments attempt to make this bill constitutional, at least better than the ones in Georgia, but that's what the bill is all about. I did not ask the principal from North to come today because this is, as you know, is a quickie type of public hearing, but he is not alone. I've had an opportunity to talk to some other principals that when they have individuals that they view as a risk to students, and they try to, and they can get them out of the school. They can trespass them out of the school, but then they hang around the school. As I said, he mentioned particularly a sex offender in one case and gangbangers in the others. Now, with that, we had two people signed up. both of whom opposed the bill. Thank you very much. Kathy Osborne and James Wright. So would they come forward, please?
And are they aware of the Dash 1 amendment? It may make no difference. They may not care that it's the Dash 1 amendments, but anyway. Kathy, could you go first, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Osborne from Juvenile Rights Project. I do have the Dash 1 amendments, Mr. Chair, and I still see that there is potentially a problem. It does help that the Dash 1s, that the person has to have known or should have known that the school was in session or that there's a public function at the school, but there still is essentially a problem. Most schools are placed in residential areas, so within 1,000 feet of any real property compromising school could be somebody's house. This would mean that somebody who in their house, there's a disturbance at their house, inside the house even, just because they're living within 1,000 feet of the school, and this disturbance occurs during the school hours, while there would be no public, there would be no safety problem at the actual school, just because this family happened to buy a house within 1,000 feet of a school, there could be a problem. Another additional problem is, for example, in Portland, Madison High School abuts right up against a public park. So this would include activity that occurred in a public park, even while school was in session, that may not have, again, an impact on the safety of the school. Juvenile Rights Project certainly wants to have schools the safest places that we can, and we would be in support of any legislation that would make it easier for principals to keep schools safe. But we just see significant problems with this bill.
Mr. Rice, you care to add to that?
James Rice, Jordan, Criminal Defense Lawyers. I'll be very brief. I listened to the concern that the principal had, and I can see that there is a real issue there. What I see this bill doing is simply taking it from a B misdemeanor to an A misdemeanor. Doesn't seem like it's giving much more power to the school to deal with the problem. I think Ms. Osborne really covered the concerns that I had thinking of schools in urban areas, and I'll just stand on her testimony and keep it brief. Thank you.
Well, just so you know, I'm not going to give up yet on the bill. The chair may tell me I am going to give up on it, but I'm going to say I thought I had it made with Georgia, and the legislative council came up with, I think, a two-page letter that pointed out why they thought the Georgia law, which obviously, I don't know if they know it or not, maybe they can get away with it in Georgia. It's unconstitutional. Bill, you want to help me here?
Mr. Chairman,
they both destroyed my pet bill that I love so much, and I thought it was going to do so much good for all the schools in Oregon. Would you please help me?
Mr. Osborne, you talked about the safety of the school, but we're talking about the disorderly conduct statute. So when you mentioned the park, if someone decided to put 12-foot speakers next to the park pointed towards the school, wouldn't that now constitute disorderly conduct?
That certainly would be.
Sure. Yeah. So it's not just safety, but it's also causing a disturbance that would bother the school.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Counsel, yes, that is correct. Disorderly conduct would be disorderly conduct now. It would just be now a Class A misdemeanor because it occurred within 1,000 feet of the school if this legislation were to pass.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Osborne, again, now it says, is there any suggestions that you would have that would make this tie more closely to the school? I think you mentioned a fight in the neighborhood.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Counsel, I've been sitting in the back of the room trying to figure out how we could amend this. There probably is a way. I have not thought of it as of now. I'd certainly be willing to sit down with the chair and with counsel and see if we can come up with a way to make this bill narrow enough in scope that it would do what the schools needed to do but wouldn't be overbroad for the people that happen to be owning property within 1,000 feet of the school property.
Chair, members of the committee, I think we have an offer to assist in drafting this.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. It's distracted by another getting on the bill. What did you say, please?
Chairman, I think Ms. Osborne has suggested that she would help work with us, too.
I thought I heard that. Mr. Rice, are you of your mind to be willing to at least talk about it a little bit further?
And I am. Senator Courtney, I'd be happy to meet with her.
I didn't know it was to be a knight on a white horse here. The issue was brought to me, I think, very legitimately by the principal, and
I don't want to be something unconstitutional, however, and I do respect that, or I would have just tried to jam through the Georgia statute without telling anybody, but it wouldn't, I don't know how far it would have gotten, but I don't want to produce feel-good legislation that's basically unconstitutional if it takes 2 or 3 years to get to the point where it's unconstitutional. But I would like to see if we can do something here, we do it. If we can't, we can't. We just don't make it, and that's life. I mean, life's tough for all of us a little bit, but I would like to see that. So could we maybe work on this?
Sure, members of the committee, maybe if they would accompany me outside and resolve the Senate chambers.
Now, any other questions, though, Senator Tarno, Senator Brown, about this?
Nope.
Do they understand what
we're sure, that's a concept, and I would hope they use some of those things.
Okay. I thank you very much for coming, because I think they'll take care of 844. Excuse me.
I just wanted to ask the question whether Oregon is hyper-constitutional or something. Since, is it hyper or hypo? Whatever it is.
Just a minute. Let me have my... Can I just do this?
Too much constitution?
But where is it? Bill, could you
Georgia?
Talk? Just a minute.
That's the law?
Theirs is unconstitutional.
It was declared unconstitutional?
Just one second. It's the peace thing. A lot of peace. That's Georgia.
This is the letter, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I don't want to... Let me...
I thought that the person from the school said that Georgia had the law. You got the statute from Georgia, and then our legislative council told you that the law was unconstitutional. I'd like to know, did Georgia strike it down?
In conclusion, a proposal to prohibit loitering within 1,000 feet of a school raises issues under state and federal constitutions because it would fail to give the required notice and would allow arrest based on suspicions rather than probable cause. That was the conclusion. Well, here's the letter. Georgia, it's my opinion, Georgia's
going to... by a different constitution?
Well...
I mean, not state, U.S.
Excuse me. I've never been to Georgia. Yes, I did. The plane landed there once in Delta. But somehow they got a statute. It's on the books. And maybe nobody challenged it. Or maybe...
Maybe.
I'm just telling you what...
What I understand, I read this letter about 2 or 3 weeks ago, Mr. Chairman of the Committee, Senate Future. And what it says is that Oregon at one time had a loitering statute.
Mm-hmm.
Georgia has one now that requires for this. And in 1975, the Oregon Court of Appeals declared the Oregon statute unconstitutional because it did not give fair notice on Article 1, Section 20, and then Article 1, Section 9 of the Oregon Constitution and the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution. Arrest must be made upon probable cause. That's it.
But, anyway.
He wasn't a recent Supreme Court decision.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Rice, did you want
to... No. One brief comment. I also see a potential problem here with what the founding fathers of the United States called freedom of assembly. People have a right to get together and meet in groups. And a problem is when someone looks at a group and simply says, I don't want them to be together. And it's something we need to look into in addressing this problem to have it meet United States constitutional standards.
I just want to know where Mr. Rice was when I've been making some of my founding father speeches that I didn't see you at or hear you at, and I'll call on you again. Some of the same Soviet Union stuff is really bothering me, too.
Senator Tuchev, you could talk to Chairman Mannix. I really work on that side more, and I'll let him give you an opinion of what I speak about. Thank you. I'd be happy to.
I'm sorry that... He wasn't there with your founding fathers and the
Soviet
Union.
What I want to know is, where are the founding mothers?
Oh, excuse me.
They weren't a mother at the time.
I'm sorry.
You need to control.
This is a founding mother-father thing. Anyway, let's find each other in the hall. Yes, Jackie, do you want to say something?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I was actually going to make an offer that I would be willing to do some research and find out if the Georgia statute has been challenged in Georgia.
I want to do it right here if we can do it here, with all due respect to Georgia. But that's up to you. All right, hold the hearing 844 to open the public hearing on, I guess, I'm going to have to do this. Senate Bill 546, because the bar people are here. Dave Barrels is not here, and Steve NATO is not here. They're the ones that are for this bill, but they, I have to admit, I've gone beyond the time designated for them, so in deference to the people from the bar, I've been waiting. Oh, here they are. Oh, here we are. All right, here we go. Okay. Steve, step up. Let's all step up. I want everybody up. I want the bar up here, too. I want you all together on this, please.
Okay, yeah, good. Okay. Now, Dave, come and see.
Just us.
Yes, I. All right. Okay, now. You're all ready. Okay. Mr. Nato,
yes.
Why don't you begin, because the bill was introduced to you and you know the issue, and then we'll go to the bar, because I understand there's been some work done. There's also an amendment involved, and I understand that there's a letter that's been exchanged, although that letter had not been seen by Mr. Barrows. It's an 8-page letter. I don't want you to read an 8-page letter today, because this is a very interesting hearing we got on here, hearing 20 bills. This keeps bills alive, called Tap Tap. We're doing more than Tap Tap, okay? Okay. Mr. Nato,
thank you,
please.
Senator. The revised bill, or amended Senate Bill 746, is designed to solve a current problem which I believe exists in corporate law today, and that is corporate law is designed for large publicly held corporations which have thousands of shareholders, and the theory is that you cannot let one shareholder with 100 shares of Nike stock stop the company from doing business, or getting their approval to make decisions would be extremely difficult. And so the corporate law has a concept called the board of directors. The board of directors runs the company. The board is elected by a majority of the votes of the shareholders. And
not to interrupt you, Mr. Nato, but you said 746, and I think you mean 546.
Yes, thank you.
And so that when anybody goes back to the record, they're not
thank you,
missing
Senator.
It. So.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hughes, for
welcome.
Being so loose as far as I think. Go ahead.
But the recourse that a minority shareholder has in a publicly held company is very powerful, and that is they can walk down to their local broker and sell their shares. In a closely held corporation, that is a corporation that is not publicly traded and has a smaller number of shareholders, the situation is fundamentally different. And there are two primary reasons. One is there is no market for the shares of the closely held corporation, so a minority shareholder who is unhappy has really nowhere to go. They're essentially locked into the corporation. The second fundamental difference is that people who invest in small, closely held corporations don't do it just for the financial investment. In many cases, they are joining a business with friends, with family members, and they do it for a job, for ability to work in a business, to participate in the business. So it's different than when you invest in Nike or IBM, where you just are looking for a financial return. So the question is, what happens when problems occur, dissension occurs amongst these shareholders? What happens is then the rules of corporate law allow the become tools for oppression, if you will. And what happens is the majority shareholder who elects the board then decides who gets to work in the business, whether or not dividends are paid, and how much people get paid. So the board could fire the minority shareholder, stop paying dividends, and increase the salary of the majority shareholder. And all of these things are perfectly legitimate under corporate law today. So the legislature has previously recognized this problem, and it adopted what is currently ORS 60.661 and gave minority shareholders the right to sue the dissolution of the corporation based on the oppression of the majority shareholders. And the problem with the current bill and what Senate Bill 546 attempts to do is that the current standard, or there is no real standard for oppression. It's very difficult to know when it occurs, kind of like pornography. I mean, the courts know it when they see it, but you cannot predict. So what this bill tries to do is adopt an objective standard that will help courts, will help shareholders and their attorneys help predict and model their conduct after, you know, what is the appropriate conduct. And the bill has language that we took out of similar bills that have been passed in Minnesota and North Dakota. It's also the reasonable expectation standard has been applied by appellate courts in over 13 states, and to my knowledge, no appellate court that has reviewed the standard has rejected it. So all of the courts that have actually taken up the issue have approved this standard for determining whether oppression exists. Let me go back. The standard is what the courts would do is they would
look at the majority shareholder's conduct to see whether or not it frustrated the reasonable expectations of the minority shareholders and determine whether or not oppression had occurred. And those reasonable expectations then relate to things like employment, participation in management, and dividends, and things that, you know, relate to the business. And the key word is reasonable expectations. That means these are expectations that are objective, they're known to all the parties, and so it is something that can be ascertained by a court. The other thing to note is this standard, this reasonable expectation standard, is currently used in Oregon in contract law. All contracts in Oregon have an implied obligation of good faith. The way the courts determine whether that's been upheld or performed is they look to the reasonable expectations of the contracting party. So this is a standard that the courts are familiar with and are able to deal with. Why is the bill needed now? There are an increasing number of these cases coming in front of the courts. I'm aware of two cases currently in the Court of Appeals, one at the Supreme Court, and I'm aware of numerous circuit court cases, at least in Multnomah County. And I think a large part of the reason why this is occurring is that there's a large number of businesses that are changing hands over the next 5 to 10 years as the post-World War II generation of entrepreneurs are transferring their businesses. And these disputes occur in many cases during a succession of a business from one generation to the next or between parties. There's another reason why the bill is needed is the cost of resolving these disputes is astronomical. And one of the reasons why they're astronomical is because the standard is so vague that lawyers and judges, it's very difficult to know what it is that is oppression, so you have to cover every base, every potential aspect of the relationship between the parties, and it's the relationship goes back 30 years, that's a lot of ground to cover. I'm aware of one trial that took over 6 months to resolve. Another reason why the cost is so astronomical is it's not just two lawyers that are involved. It's not just a lawyer for the majority and a minority. There's a third lawyer. The corporation has to have a lawyer. I mean, if this was ever the Legal Full Employment Act, these types of cases really fall under that situation. So in summary, I think that this is a fair bill. It's balanced. It helps both the majority and the minority shareholders know what is the standard of conduct. And I think it will be reduce the amount of litigation in this area and will reduce the scope of the litigation that occurs. I did have a chance to talk to one minority shareholder who was involved in one of these disputes over 20 years ago. It involved a family of at least four siblings, and he has not spoken to his brothers and sisters since that occurred, so that these can be very disruptive and permanent disputes that occur amongst these shareholders who again, in many cases, in these closely held corporations, start out at least with a close personal relationship. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nato. Anna, do you have any comments for the record?
No,
sure. Any testimony on behalf of the barrels?
No, actually, I think
Ms. Nato covered it perfect. All right, how does the bar want to handle this? There's two of you. I know we have this letter from Mr. Bullock.
Yes, Senator Perkins. My name is Brent Bullock. I am a partner with Perkins Coie in Portland. I've been practicing business law in Oregon for 13 years. I'm also a member of the executive committee of the business law section of the bar, and am here as a representative of that executive committee. I want to make clear that we're not representing the bar itself. We're representing the executive committee of the business law section. The section itself has over 1,100 members, and I understand Mr. Nato is a member of the bar, so I can't say that we're speaking for every single member in the 1,100 who are here. But I do speak on behalf of the representatives of the executive committee, which are members who serve on the board throughout the state of Oregon, representing both large and small corporations, privately held businesses throughout the state, both east of the mountains and west of the mountains. Oregon law currently contains certain protections for the rights of minority shareholders, and Mr. Nato addressed that issue. I guess one of the things that I want to make clear is that Oregon law does not currently permit majority shareholders to act oppressively towards minority shareholders. The law is pretty clear. In fact, Oregon courts have interpreted the language that's in the statute quite broadly. Mm-hmm. They talk about things like burdensome, harsh, wrongful, violations of fair dealing and fair play, breaches of fiduciary duty, loyalty, good faith, and fair dealing. All of those are standards of law of Oregon that exist today. In fact, the Oregon Supreme Court indicated that in determining what the definition of oppression ought to be, it was very wary of adopting a specific definition for oppression, concerned that you really do have to look at the specific facts of the circumstance, facts and circumstances to determine what might go on and figure out in light of all of the things taken into consideration whether a specific circumstance might constitute oppression and might not. So they've been fairly hesitant to go forward and actually try and adopt a specific definition for that. Courts as well, and one of the things that the legislation does, which I think many people believe would be a useful tool, is that it provides a vehicle other than going through the dissolution process to allow shareholders, when a dispute does arise, to have the ability to allow for a buyout of minority rather than requiring that there be a dissolution of the corporation. However, again, Oregon Supreme Court has already adopted that as the law in Oregon. It may not exist in the legislation itself, but Oregon courts have that as a tool available to them and, in fact, have used it in the past. I'm actually unaware of any recent reported legal decisions that I believe have come to a wrong conclusion, but this is true. I'm sure that there are cases that are pending in courts throughout the state that deal with this issue because it is an issue that can come up from time to time. The primary purpose of the legislation, at least as I view the legislation that's being proposed by Mr. Nadeau, is really to, in some respects, lower or focus the definition of what you might constitute oppression to be on reasonable expectations. And to be honest, I think we as members of the executive committee are concerned that that may be a little bit too low of a threshold. We're also concerned that that may place a little bit too much emphasis on reasonable expectations of shareholders as opposed to, say, the best interest of the corporation on a long term in general as opposed to the interest of any one particular shareholder. It also expands the scope to include reasonable expectations beyond the scope of merely being a shareholder. Actually, the courts already take that into consideration, but the way the language is drafted, it caused some concerns as to whether or not an individual whose interest really might be primarily that of an employee of the corporation but receives maybe a token share as an employee stockholder plan might be able to, after a termination that they believe to be wrongful, somehow give them a basis to be able to have the corporation dissolved when, in fact, that was really just a small piece of the puzzle and they really aren't part of this closely held group. It also, as I indicated, permits shareholders to elect to have their stock repurchased, something that's different in this legislation, proposed legislation, than exists in other places. Under Oregon law currently, the judge has the ability to determine whether or not dissolution would be the proper course of conduct or whether a sale or other action would be appropriate. The legislation that's being proposed states that dissolution is the course and that the minority shareholder has the ability to petition the corporation, or I'm sorry, the court, to be able to have a buyout, as opposed to, as is the case, to be honest, in most other jurisdictions that have adopted legislation like this, either have it be with the judge, be with the majority, in fact, to elect whether or not they'd like to buy out the dissenting shareholders' interest, or with all of the various parties having the ability to do that. Some of the more notable concerns I've addressed already. Other issues, there are some specific concerns that exist with regard to the language. We really don't see this legislation as something of utmost urgency. The law in Oregon right now does address the issue. It is true it's not probably as clear as I think people would like it to be in many respects. There are some reasons for that, possibly good, possibly bad, but there are reasons for it that give some flexibility to the courts to really look at the entire picture. We're concerned that the legislature not act in haste and adopt this legislation. The legislation that's being proposed right now primarily comes from legislation that was adopted in Minnesota. It's since been adopted also in North Dakota. I don't necessarily think of those jurisdictions as cutting-edge corporate law policy-type jurisdictions. Other jurisdictions have taken slightly different approaches. An example in California, you actually have a closely held corporation statute that if you want to be inside the scope of this law that deals with closely held corporations, you actually incorporate or elect to be a participant in the laws that exist so that the shareholders know what the rules of the game are going to be with regard to that. Other jurisdictions have taken positions or approaches where not every shareholder has the ability to work through the process, but really they would consider only significant shareholders. So you have to be a 20% shareholder to be able to work through a process like this, which is an approach that was taken by New York. I guess my point here is that there are all sorts of options that exist throughout the various different states, including the Model Business Corporation Act, of which our corporate law is a basis, has adopted a provision that deals with the buyout section. I don't know that, to be honest, I don't believe that necessarily the laws of Minnesota, which would have been derived from reaction to specific cases and things might have gone on there, should necessarily be adopted by the state of Oregon. And we're not so much concerned with dealing with the issue, to be honest. There are many of us on our executive committee that believe that that's appropriate. We are concerned, though, with the specifics of this legislation and whether or not this legislation would be appropriate to be adopted without really looking at all the various different issues that exist. And a couple points that I want to raise out that are still questions that aren't addressed by the legislation. Is it better if it's reasonable expectations versus good faith and fair dealing, which is currently under law, or the burdensome, harsh, or wrongful conduct? Which of those is a better approach to take? Should you weigh and balance the interest of the corporation generally, independent of the interest of any specific shareholder? They use a closely held corporation definition of 25 shareholders or less. Well, some corporations with more than 25 shareholders may in fact be closely held, and some that are much are that size are clearly not closely held. So using just a strict number may not necessarily be the right approach to take. Should it be an opt-in or an opt-out, like California has approached? Would that be a better way to do it, to let people know if they really want to participate and be involved in this? If you're going to have a closely held corporation, choose the laws that you want to have as opposed to having them thrust upon you. Should there be an objective standard versus a subjective standard for reasonableness? Is it something that occurs when the corporation is initially conceived and formed? Or if you have a change in shareholders, as an example, maybe you have inheritances that go on or transfers to family members, would it be the original generation's interest, say they wanted to have the corporation reinvest its proceeds and continue to grow, yet a subsequent shareholder's interest might be somewhat different from that? Whose do you look at then in that circumstance if that subsequent shareholder believes that dividends paid out should be what they get, even though the original incorporators believe that the corporation should invest and build and grow? All of these are issues, and there's more issues, but all of these are issues that I think really ought to be looked at, and our committee is committed, in fact, and we've agreed that we would look at this in connection with our law improvement to analyze the other jurisdictions, the case law in Oregon, current law in Oregon, cases in other jurisdictions, legislation in other jurisdictions, to really have a thoughtful analysis and approach to the legislation to make sure that we deal with all of the various issues that are involved here and have it be at the best interest of Oregon, Oregonians generally. Thank you for your time. I turn it over to Brendan McDonald, also a member of the executive committee.
Good afternoon, Senators. My name is Brendan McDonald. I'm a partner at Tonkin Thorpe. I specialize in corporate and securities laws. I've been representing growth companies for 13 years. I'm also a co-founder of an organization called the Oregon Young Entrepreneurs Association, which boasted approximately 800 members before it was merged into the Oregon Entrepreneurs Forum. I think it's important that I point out that our firm represents the H. NATO Corporation. I am not here today at all to represent that corporation. I'm here solely to represent my own views and those of the Executive Committee of the Oregon State Bar Business Section. First, I'd like to voice my support of Mr. Bullock's comments. I agree wholeheartedly with everything that he just said. I'd like to make just a couple of practical points about the bill. In representing growth companies, one of the things I've come to recognize is that investors truly appreciate predictability. And that is why many investors insist that corporations are formed in Delaware, because their body of case law and their statutory law is very predictable. Our Oregon law, in many ways, tracks Delaware law. This proposed legislation will not track Delaware law. And that concerns me about the interest of investors in investing in Oregon corporations. Predictability is important since investors do not like litigation. This statute, as revised, in my opinion, will lead to additional litigation. And that is a very important issue to an investor who's putting money into an entrepreneurial company. Another point that also relates to it, and most of the companies I represent have modeled their corporate structure after the Silicon Valley model, where you share equity with employees to grow the company, much like Microsoft or Starbucks or Amazon.com. And in doing so, they are actually giving out stock options to employees. In this legislation, there would be a particular right that would go to an optionee who exercised the option and also was an employee of the company. That employee would then have a right to possibly even dissolve the corporation. That would be against the interest of the corporation, which is to move along the growth curve and eventually hopefully go public and become one of the public companies that Mr. Nato has mentioned. Those are just a few of my concerns concerning the legislation. It's not that I'm against improving the law so that we protect minority shareholders well in this state. I'm against doing so without looking very carefully at what the changes might do to invest in our Oregon corporations. Thank you.
Senator, may I respond to a few other remarks? Number one is we're more than happy to discuss with the executive committee of the business section of the bar some any particular language changes or issues they want to address to try and make the bill better. I mean, my intent is to have a better law for the state of Oregon. All I've gotten, of course, or to date, all I've heard is these responses that we need more time to study. We have these concerns. There's plenty of time between now and the end of session to work on this bill. Let's just roll up our sleeves and get to work and do it. The question about Minnesota and North Dakota, as I said, there are 13 other states where the courts have already adopted the reasonable expectation standards, and so there would be no impetus for the legislature to adopt those. And those states include New York and New Jersey, which are large corporate law states. I think the issue about the growth companies, the Silicon Valley companies, I mean, those are all designed to grow up to be publicly held companies. These are not the type of businesses and the issues that we're trying to focus in on this legislation. If there are concerns specifically in that area, we can craft language that would deal with that to protect these growth companies. I smile that my fellow members of the bar continue to use the terrible results of dissolution of these companies. Even under the current law, which says the remedy is dissolution, no court in the state of Oregon has ever dissolved, ordered the dissolution of a company. The remedies are out there, are myriad of them, and any viable business will not be dissolved under this statute. And in fact, the statute itself changes the word from judicial dissolution to judicial intervention to give the court this broad equitable relief. So the last thing that any court is going to do is to dissolve a viable business. The other question I had is, I think, Brent, you got the wrong draft of the bill because we've taken out all the purchase options sections in there. So it's just the bill currently, it just says that the adopts the paragraph in putting in the reasonable expectation standards, so there's no buyout provisions that you need to worry about.
No, no. Okay. The letter that which you've received includes a draft that Steve sent to me earlier in March, and we actually tried to find out whether it was the same that had been or was being proposed, but we hadn't found that out before we responded. As I've indicated, I guess the buyout provision actually is something I think the Revised Model Business Corporation Act has actually included provisions for, which is probably one of the easier things to include because people recognize that section itself is something that benefits both the minority and the majority shareholder in allowing the corporation to more easily go through a process of not being dissolved. Any questions?
Mr. Barrows, do you have any comments or questions you want to add? Did you just come in? Comments, concerns from
Senator Brown. I guess I just asked the executive committee: do they have a work plan in terms of taking a look and working with Steve to resolve his concerns? What's the section sort of?
Well, at this point, as you might imagine, there are a number of bills that are going through the legislature. There was an initial bill that was submitted, and we spent a good deal of time through our committees analyzing that, and we sent a letter in opposition, and that bill has subsequently been withdrawn. Steve and I have had conversations, and he forwarded a copy of the bill to me and indicated that he was going to try and bring that up here as well. We've had meetings and discussions again on this as well. To be honest, I don't know what the timing standpoint is from this legislative session. We have, and I've gotten the executive committee to commit to forming a subcommittee to deal with these issues. I honestly, Steve is far more familiar because of his involvement in matters going on, litigation is proceeding right now with what the status of the law is in many jurisdictions. I've taken a very quick look, in part based on information he's provided me, which has assisted me, but I honestly, it would be difficult for me to say at this time how long it would take to go through that analysis and get together with large groups and try and figure out what might be the appropriate provisions to get incorporated in. It's difficult for me to say.
Anything further? Well, let me tell you where I am on this. Senator Bryan, who's chair of the committee, and I have talked about this bill. He'd be here today, but he's in North Carolina at a national conference of state legislators. He flew out yesterday. We're hearing 17 bills today, and I wanted this bill to be one of them. And the reason is because I want to keep this bill alive. Today is official public hearing, and I would hope that the bar, would continue to work with Mr. Nato on this legislation at this time to see if we can't come together with something so that we can move the bill. This is a right now a legislature, so it isn't just this side, but the other side of opportunity. So when the chair returns from North Carolina, I'll get you in a minute, Senator, I don't interrupt you. He and I will sit down and discuss the 17 bills that we've been hearing here today to discuss what bills will go forward. So and he and I have personally, privately discussed this bill on several occasions. So I would like to say to the bar that I would hope that you will continue to work hard on the bill. Mr. Nato, I hope you will continue to work with him as well. I understand the bill has already changed in format, to say the least. I don't need to know the details because these things give me trouble, details, and I'm not very good. I'm a big picture type of guy. I get all lost here, you know what I mean? As everybody knows. And so I just look at things from a distance. Senator Brown?
Sorry for interrupting.
That's fine.
I thought maybe you were done with your... I just wanted the bar committee folks know that the Senate bill deadline date is April 30th, so we're running out of time here. So I appreciate the bar has processes, but might want to speed those up a bit.
Thank you. Say, because of the magnitude of bills that have come into this committee, the chair of a court release in my paper this morning is that this may be one of the committees that's held open for a period of time longer than most because we have a tremendous workload. So the bar, I don't mean to speak to you as though you represent the bar, but as you understand, that I'd like to see if some more work can be done so we can keep this thing going at this time. I'm not ready to start talking interim on April 16th. I'm not ready to start hearing that word. I mean, you know what I mean? That's just where it is. But the chair will have to make a final decision.
I understand, sir.
Anything further for the record at this time? I realize you were scheduled at 1:20. I thank you for your patience. And with that, I will adjourn the hearing on Senate Bill 546. So, open the hearing on Senate Bill 996. Case King, Sharon Hill, would you step forward, please? I do thank the committee for you kind of cute sub. I thank you for being willing to do this session. Appreciate it.
It's only so long, so
yeah. I'm doing it. Yeah.
Well, good.
Okay. Would you please proceed?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Sharon Hill, Legislative Assistant with Senator Abel Gordley's office, and I do appreciate the time this afternoon as well. So I'll be brief to set up a historical context for Katie King from the Health Division. Last session, Senator Gordley's office worked with Rod Harder of the NRA to talk about how do we approach all of the preventable accidental shootings of young people, getting their hands on guns, not just suicides. And one of the things that Rod said was don't vilify firearms. There are other weapons that are involved. And he also said that he had a recommendation in terms of, mandating the Eddie Eagle program. But we kept talking about how do we get to something, and he suggested broadening the scope. And what we ended up doing by the end of session is Senator Gordley and Senator Ferrioli actually recommended a violent injury data system. Let's get the kind of information across agencies, state police and the health division, to actually look at the situation so that we actually have information to provide to policymakers so we can talk about the issues beyond rhetoric and figure out how can we actually approach the situation in a constructive fashion. Some of the issues around violent injury, it's the relationship between the victims. It might be substance abuse issues. It could be whether it's a safe storage of a weapon or not. But those issues don't always just house in a data that the health division has. Sometimes it's what the law enforcement data system has. And so we had the state police and the health division working together on that last session. And in the interim, the health division took the initiative to get Center for Disease Control funding to begin an injury prevention surveillance program. So I kind of want to turn it over to Katie King with the health division to tell you where we're at in terms of data that would then lead us to the place to say, are we ready to have a task force start looking at strategically what do we do with the information and how do we address preventable accidental injuries and deaths?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Katie King and I'm the legislative liaison for the Oregon Health Division. And I'll be brief here since I know we're short on time, but I wanted to direct your attention to a fact sheet that I've attached to my testimony. And it's entitled, Don't Let Violence Destroy Oregon. And what it does is it gives you a developing picture of the violence that exists in our communities, in our neighborhoods, in our schools, in fact, throughout the entire state. There were a total of 49,388 reported crimes against persons committed in Oregon in 1996. And the rest of the list goes through and it kind of details other types of crimes. Murder, homicide, rape, kidnapping, simple assault, robberies, domestic violence. All of these are critical issues facing Oregonians today. The Governor's Violent Injury Task Force is one mechanism which would help us to provide a strong foundation for studying violence, where it occurs, who are the victims, who are the perpetrators, what are the circumstances. And once we've done that, we can start working on bringing solutions to these very serious problems. Violence is a law enforcement issue, a public health issue, an alcohol and drug issue, and an education issue. The health division is prepared to bring data to the table. And we are currently working with other states to pull together violence data. And we are also working with the state police. And a couple of other resources that we use the Fatal Accident Reporting System from the Oregon Department of Transportation. We use emergency room data. We take a very close look at youth risk behavior. And we also have a child fatality review section, which compiles data from local county level teams that look at child death. Once we've collected all of this data, it makes sense to turn to a violent injury task force to mobilize our resources, to plan, to strategize, and finally to implement solutions. Thank you very much for your time.
Yes, question.
Sure. I guess it's just a bit of self-interest, but if the health division has all the data and all the experts, why is legislative council going to staff this now?
Part of the issue is from the work we did last time, and I actually didn't talk to Captain Schmidt this week, but there's specific information about the crimes that actually the police have more access to, and what we were trying to work on last session was how do we interrelate the data. And so the health division has a certain set. They have the child fatality team actually is the only instance, correct me if I'm wrong, where they do have a cross-agency sharing of information. But they're two totally separate information systems. And so you have to somehow share those in order to get at, are we talking about alcohol? Are we talking about domestic violence? What are the issues? And then how do we then target the strategies on a local level, a public health level, et cetera? So it's that combination of doing that, and it's not just as judiciary isn't just about lawyers and judges, it's about all the perspectives that you can bring, and it's across disciplines now in terms of being not only law enforcement, but as Katie said, a public health issue, an education issue. So it's bringing them.
Okay.
The two data systems are separate.
Yeah. for providing the staff work, and I'm just not so sure it's a legislative council. I'm not so sure.
Mr. Chair,
I was
going to
say, I don't think she wanted to be
the
council staff
member,
so.
Further questions? Comments?
Thank you
very much. Thank you. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 996. Senator Starr, you're here. Help me. Open the public. Reopen the public hearing on Bill 1215. Would you step forward, please?
Thank you.
Sure. Sure, Senator Stark, please.
This covenant marriage bill is a bill that's modeled on legislation that has been passed in Louisiana. And it was brought to my attention by Michael Howden, who is the founder of the Oregon Family Policy. I believe that's the name of the organization. I'm sorry that I don't have that in front of me so I could be absolutely sure. But anyway, Michael Howden is working on family-related issues. Essentially as something of a missionary, self-supported, raises his own support, and working with organizations within the state of Oregon to bring attention to issues that affect our families. And there are 37 such councils throughout the United States. And so they're bringing this covenant marriage issue to the forefront throughout the nation. And the idea is simply that we believe that we can strengthen marriage if there be stronger requirements pre-marriage and then stronger requirements for divorce or separation after the marriage compact or after the marriage ceremony. Prior to bringing this bill forward, the city of Corvallis has, through the ministerial association of the city, come together, and 77 ministers signed a compact to honor covenant marriages and to provide the premarital counseling and postmarital support for married couples, postmarriage support. As a kind of an anecdotal story, the chaplain at the university, first three couples coming forward for marriage, two of them were counseled about the possibility of covenant marriage, and during the counseling, premarital counseling, they determined that really they shouldn't marry. And the third couple agreed to be married under covenant marriage agreement and to go through the premarital counseling and were married. But we have no covenant marriage law that would support or sustain that program. And so we've brought the concept to you in this bill. It allows for those who have never married or who are contemplating marriage to be married under a covenant marriage arrangement, and for those who have been married for many years to, in fact, go through a ceremony and affirm their marriage vows under a covenant marriage arrangement. And I think that anything that we might do as a state government to encourage and strengthen the marriage in our state, we would, in fact, be addressing many of the social ills that affect our society in great depth.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Senator Shannon came earlier, and as a former family law lawyer, I'm very intrigued by this proposal. And I guess as I look at some of the information you provided to us, one of my questions I asked Senator Shannon earlier is the impact it has on the divorce process itself, and that the lawyers who used to do the fault divorce hated it because everything got so acrimonious. It required investigators. It was much more expensive. It was much more time-consuming. And I think what we've done over the last few years in our family law system is try to make it less adversarial because the children come out better that way. And so my question would be for you, if parties and staff do go through the covenant divorce requiring someone to prove adultery or whatever, won't that have a much more harmful impact on the children in that particular family than if the parties simply could be allowed to, you know, go their own ways and ask for property and spousal support, et cetera, and then divide up?
Well, I'm sure that that might be the case. But if we, in fact, through the required counseling and separation phases, we saved half those marriages, they would be miles ahead in overall than we would if we allowed the easy no-fault divorce. I didn't go on the record. I'd like my L.A. to respond. He's been talking to a representative from Louisiana who, in fact, has some experience with the law. I'm State Senator Charles Starr, District 5, and this is Ken McDermott, my legislative assistant. If you permit Ken to respond to that, he's been talking to the folks who have been involved the longest now in this.
But you're according to Senator Brown. I talked to Representative Perkins from the Louisiana legislature specifically about that. The law has only been in effect less than 2 years in Louisiana, so it's hard statistics to really...
Hopefully we haven't had a whole lot of divorces in that time.
Well, that's correct. There have been no divorces in the covenant marriage in that time frame. There have been, however, mandatory counseling sessions that have averted divorces. They don't have hard statistics on those yet. They're still working at getting that. There have been some grants awarded to study the effects of covenant marriage, but it is, in that effect, it is still relatively new. I believe you also asked a question about how many participated, and the best statistics they have so far has been 3% have participated. In light of that figure, though, you need to keep in mind that a Gallup poll conducted in the state of Louisiana pointed out that only 43% of the respondents even knew covenant marriage existed. But when it was explained to them, over 81% thought it was either a good idea or a very good idea. It's so far it is having a positive effect. It's still too early to have hard statistics on it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make some comments. I happen to be a co-sponsor, I am also sponsoring this bill, not as chief co-sponsor, but my name's on it. And I wanted to make comment about your issue, Senator Brown, and being in family law, and that maybe when there's a more amicable dissolution of marriage, that it helps the children. And I've been reading recent reports that have come out both about child abuse and about children who are in families that don't have fathers. A large study has come out and a couple of books that I have in my office about that. And I think there's going to be a study released that is specific to Oregon about that. That really, the kids that are doing the worst are the ones that don't have both parents in their family. And I understand there are reasons for divorce, sort of this bill, and it states those reasons. And usually when that kind of thing happens, there's going to be, people get hurt in divorces, period. I mean, emotionally. But I've been particularly concerned, too, just in my past serving in the legislature with the child abuse that occurs. I know you're concerned about that, too, but just the recent testimony that we've had in the Human Resource Subcommittee is appalling to me. It is very troubling to me. And then I got from the DHR the new incident study that came out on child abuse. And when you read that report, it talks about children who are in families with their biological parents do much better. It's the families where there are, you know, there's not a biological parent or they're not married or whatever. And so I think at least 60% of the abuse cases, might even be a higher percentage, just going off the top of my head. But it's just been amazing to me in looking at these statistics that the reason we have so much trouble, I think, is because we've lost this foundation of marriage and it's too easy to go in and out of these marriages. And so if we have something like this covenant marriage, people will, one, think more about it before they go into it, get counseling before they go into it. And as Senator Stark said, a couple of them that went there in Corvallis, of the three that went, two decided not to get married. And two, it makes it a little more difficult to separate and maybe try to work it out and actually do the very best for their kids and not go through this situation of divorcing. So it wasn't a question, it was kind of a
question.
Or a testimony type, because I'm...
Yeah, we have a fairly conducted this meeting today. We had a freedom of expression and dialogue.
I have the opportunity to read both of Judith Wallerstein's books, and I can't remember the name of them off the top of my head, but I just thought they were very fascinating and very sad. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Star. Thank you for coming here.
Thank you.
And Senator Shannon succeeded you.
All right. Appreciate that.
So she was here. And she,
hearing. And,
in fact, she came over and whispered in my ear.
Heard that you'd consider it favorable.
Thank you.
I'll get back to my committee.
Oh, you got a committee too, huh? I didn't think anybody's meeting fast
enough. By the way,
Charles,
the
committee.
The Oregon Center for Family Policy.
Okay. I closed the public hearing on 12:15, and I need to go back to, the Honorable Judge Frank Gargan, would you please come forward? Let me open the hearing on 12:92. I thought you had been told you didn't have to come up from Eugene. I feel really bad about this. I've already put it on the record and gave a written statement to my wife and me that you were very much against this bill, so I feel very badly. But could you step forward, please? Why don't you come forward? And
thank you.
We've already represented for the record that you don't like this bill, but I hope you didn't just drive up to Eugene for it, because you preside in Vail, or no, where do you preside?
No.
Vail.
I'm sorry.
Not Vail, Colorado.
I know not Vail, Colorado, but it's not just on the block. The guy has come from some distance.
I was in Eugene today.
He was just in the block down the road. I'm sorry. Okay.
Compared to Eastern Oregon, it is.
Okay. Well, please, Your Honor.
Chairman Courtney and distinguished members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, my name is Frank Uroglin. I'm one of your circuit judges in Far Eastern Oregon, Southeastern Oregon, Mahir County. For 20 years, I had both Kearney and Mahir, and now, primarily because of the placement of the Snake River Correctional Institution in Mahir County, those judicial districts have been revised. It is because of what we have done at Snake River Correctional Institution that this bill is coming on for your consideration. I am here to indicate that the Oregon Judicial Department at this point does oppose this particular bill. Also, Mr. Chairman, has your committee received a letter of response that was written by Linda Zuckerman to a number of attorneys and individuals who raised concerns? And that's been incorporated?
I have that letter. In fact, I have my hand on it right here.
Very good.
That letter was submitted. It's a March 30, 1999 letter.
Yes.
Yeah, we have that. That's part of the record.
All right. We have already held one jury trial at the Snake River Correctional Institution. We did that in February of 1999. It involved 25 witnesses, 24 of whom were inmates and correctional officers. When Fred Peirce was your director of the Department of Corrections, we first began discussing the concept of what we might be able to do to do things more effectively and efficiently with regard to prison litigation. As a result of those discussions, we did decide, and it was really in large part because of experiences in Marion County here with the fact that they had placed the courtroom facilities adjacent to the Department of Corrections, at least the County Department of Corrections. Multnomah County, if you recall, back in the mid-1980s, had a project from the Criminal Justice Center where they linked up by video. And I had the opportunity to be involved in those proceedings early on, and I was really quite impressed. But in traveling, when we were selected as a site for Snake River Correctional Institution to Umatilla and Marion primarily and sitting in those proceedings, we tried to decide what we might be able to do. We came up with two ideas that we decided to pursue. One was the video conferencing and all judicial matters now that are tried to the court in Malheur County since November of 1997 have in fact been handled via video. We also decided what to try to do with regard to the costs involving transportation as well as security concerns with regard to jury trials. And we did decide, after initial considerations as to whether there was any sort of statutory or constitutional prohibition to doing that, to proceed right from the initial step, the initial plans, to incorporate a trial facility, a trial courtroom, into Phase 2, which is associated with the visitor center. Now, any of you are familiar with the institutions that you have here in Salem, I want you to simply realize that Snake River is an entirely different type institution, a different configuration. Visualize, first of all, a very large visitor center with a complete bank of glass windows that goes very, very high that opens on to a courtyard. Visualize off of that a courtroom that in turn has a bank of windows on one side that looks out into this large visitor center and out to the courtyard in blue sky. The only reason that I indicate that is that this was purposely designed not to be some sort of facility that would not have a certain aesthetic indication or appearance. And quite frankly, upon the conclusion of our first trial, we've been trying to discuss with jurors potential concerns and various things since last fall, realizing that we would be getting into this, the reaction, and they would really have to speak for themselves, but the reaction we got back was that the particular facility was much more pleasant for them to sit in than our boxes that we provide in the county courthouse. But all that aside, I do want to indicate that the reason we are opposed is primarily because we already have one case on appeal. It is going up through the courts. It involves several issues, one of which is, for instance, public access, because we did, in fact, do that via video conferencing, playing back a continuous proceedings via video back to the courthouse for anyone who did want to come in and observe what we were doing there. That's only one aspect, and there will be various legal aspects that will have to be sorted out. Also, though, we have other cases that are actually set to take place there. Those have been consolidated now for a full hearing before a visiting judge on the site in and of itself, with the sole question being the site, which will take place on June 22nd with a visiting judge, and has consolidated a number of trials with that same issue. It may indeed be that at some point, as a matter of public policy, you want to examine this particular issue very carefully. But I would simply recommend that you proceed with at least some caution and due discretion to see how things sort out, because quite frankly, when you talk about security concerns, transportation, cost, efficiency, I hope that you too will feel that simply because we've done things a certain way in Oregon doesn't necessarily mean that they should necessarily be done that way in the future, particularly with regard to the judiciary, because quite frankly, out of the three branches of government, we're probably the least prone to be moving at times without a nudge. But we are trying to move, we are trying to address some of these overall concerns, And I think that at some future day, that would be the more appropriate time where you would have much more information and really know the parameters of the law, at least as that would be interpreted by our appellate courts, as to where we are with regard to not only courtroom siting, but also with regard to some of the technological aspects that we're trying to incorporate into our proceedings. I really brought this on the Chief Justice, I guess, in a way, and I told him I didn't mean to get you in the middle of this. He issued the Chief Justice order designating Snake River as a site. But please realize that he had also issued an order in January of 1998 that, at least from our interpretation internally, gave us the authority to do precisely what we did. I simply said, when I was given the choice, do you want an order in addition thereto? I said, yes, I would like an order. And that's why he's been brought into the middle of this. But basically, we have worked this through the Department of Corrections, and I really want to commend them, too, and commend all of you, too, not only the legislature for really forcing the process, but as well as the governor's office for giving us an opportunity in Niagara County to explore this as well as a number of other areas in a sit-down, round-table fashion involving our citizens. And this is a part of what came out of that, and it's been there for many, many years, and we've just simply been going through the steps to get to this particular process. So it isn't something that just with a pen signature suddenly came into being.
Thank you, Your Honor. Questions?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Brown.
I commented to the chair earlier, the current vice chair, that we should, this should require a road trip, that we should go visit the facility.
I've been there, though.
Okay.
Oh. I went around the state.
Not since our... Senator Cupid, since we put in the courtroom facility, we'd love to have you over to see it. Come visit in. And we really would like you to come over. I think you'd be very proud of what we have there. So thank you, Senator Browning.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'll be happy to send out a letter Monday morning.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Special invitation.
Coming up, Eugene, and putting on your testimony. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you for hearing me, and I'm sorry I was late. I didn't realize you'd taken it up earlier.
If the bill wasn't scheduled 3:10, I've been going so fast that you were timely. I've been
very efficient today.
I try to run with this group I'm with. I've got to be very good. But thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Chairman Courtney. Thank
you. Senator Schroll. The good senator from Corvallis. All of Corvallis. All of Polk County. Well, are you Corvallis? You're all the whole bit. Well, are you here on Senate Bill 1292 or is it another bill?
1292.
Okay, because that's the bill we have open for public hearing, so if you...
Mr. Chair, I was asked by an attorney by the name of Rose Jade to introduce this bill, and I decided that I would do so. I think the issue is an important one, needs to be raised, and... the bill would prohibit jury trials from taking place within the Department of Corrections institutions. And I know I don't want to cause problems for the Department of Corrections or anything like that. And I know that what they have done basically is to try to be careful as they created a jury room connected with the Snake River penal institution, but I think there are some problems regarding that. And I have a letter from Eric M. Comfer, an attorney, which I'm passing out, which speaks to the problems. And in the middle of the page, I'll read a couple of paragraphs, which I think point up the problem. There are several strong reasons why jury trials should not be held in prisons or jails. The most important is that trial sites unfairly and insidiously prejudices the jury against the defendant. I can think of no clearer violation of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution than holding a trial in a prison or jail. The courts have never directly answered that question because until now, to my knowledge, no court has ever attempted anything as reckless as attempting to hold a jury trial in a jail or prison. But the courts have held that security measures such as shackling the defendant are inherently prejudicial and contrary to the presumption of innocence. Shackling is only allowed if there is some substantial and demonstrable risk the defendant will attempt to escape or cause others harm. Holding trial in a jail or prison is even more prejudicial than shackling. It informs the jury in an unrebuttable way that the state believes the defendant is so dangerous that the trial cannot even be held in a conventional courtroom. It puts the jury in a setting dominated by prison guards, in a case in which prison guards often will testify, or usually will testify. It puts the jury at or near the scene of a crime, giving them a view of that scene, whether or not a jury view is appropriate. That's part of my problem. It seems to me that a setting of a trial is very important, and getting the jurors in and out of that facility, having a public trial, which is basically what the law calls for, and getting the public into such a facility to witness the trial, and then the effect that it has, basically, of fairness. You know, that lady depicting justice basically has a balancing act, and that balancing act is to provide a fair trial. And location has something to do with that. So I think we ought to look at that and see whether or not we really want to condone this. Again, I'm not being critical of the Department of Corrections. I know that there are a number of reasons why this makes some financial sense to do this way. And I know that they were very careful, and I have great admiration for Judge Uroglin and the judges there, and I know the judges here. So I'm not being critical of the people involved in making that decision, and I know there are some reasons that justify that decision. But I think the biggest thing we do with the trial is to provide fair and impartial justice. And I think this setting doesn't allow that to happen.
Thank you, Senator Trow. Question, Senator Trow?
Thank you very much.
Close the hearing. Close the hearing. Open the hearing on Senate Bill 843. Yes, it has. We just walked in. Dave, Schneider, you want to come up? Those are 843. And then we're going to end with the last three bills that after that. We're going to combine the last two together.
We're still way ahead of schedule, you know, folks.
How didn't you get?
Huh? We're going pretty good. I mean, we didn't, you know.
No coffee, that's all right.
Yep. All right, Dave, you want to start? Did you realize we're under, I guess you're going to make the first presentation, Mr. Schreiner?
Right, we got 10 minutes, right?
We got 10 quickies. Now,
10 quickies. We'll vote
two or 3 minutes each, okay?
Yeah, as you do this, be sure you have to give us your name. Just your name, right?
Yeah.
Just your name to the record, please. Otherwise, Mr. Schreiner.
Okay. My name's David Schreiner. I live in Kaiser, Oregon. And very briefly, what Senate Bill 843 is all about is a new vision of corporate responsibility and corporate accountability. And interestingly enough, to arrive at this vision, we went back to the roots of our democracy, and that's what this little pamphlet that I passed around is all about. I think some of you with a legal background might find this very, you know, interesting reading. This little pamphlet called Taking Care of Business by Richard Grossman. As he did research into the history, he found that citizens originally defined corporations through their corporate charters. And we want to follow the example of our country's founders and reclaim our sovereignty over corporations. We want to hold every act subservient to the will of the people. And we propose to do this effectively by reactivating the power of the people to revoke the corporate charters of abusive corporations. The bill is very specific about the conditions under which these charters can be revoked. They have to be abuse of authority, violation of state law, or contrary to the state's public policy. So it's not a carte blanche. It's effectively an attempt to balance the power between individuals and corporations back into proportion the way it should be. We are all legal persons, but individual persons should have as much power as the corporate entities. I ask you to please take time to read the wording of Senate Bill 843 and peruse the pamphlet, if you will. Finish up by saying, a century ago, Oregon was known in the progressive movement for the initiative and the referendum and the recall. And I'd ask Oregon, again, as we move into the next millennium, to again become a leader in reclaiming our corporate democracy by and making Senate Bill 843 one of those efforts. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Sheila McElrath, and I'm a citizen representative for several years on various boards and advisory councils in Marion County. I am here in support of Senate Bill 843. It is important legislation which addresses corporate responsibility to the citizens of Oregon. Since corporations are chartered by the Secretary of State to do business in Oregon, Senate Bill 843 is needed to establish a means for holding corporations responsible for any actions contrary to the public policy of the state. Citizens and communities need legislation to limit power and privilege of distant corporations who control local resources and impact natural systems for the primary purpose of generating profits. All too frequently, local municipalities must finance externalized cleanup costs from limited revenues or accept a degraded environment and compromised human health conditions as consequences of corporate practices. The dollar-driven decision-making process of corporations to privatize profits at the expense of local communities undermines democracy. It is crucial that all corporations operating in Oregon be obligated to serve the common good and to cause no harm to current or future generations. Passage of Senate Bill 843 will assure that chartered corporations doing business in Oregon shall operate within public policy requirements of the state. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Sheldon Nickel. I'm a resident of Salem, Oregon. The vision is greater wealth for everyone. Prosperity, long-term prosperity on all levels. We can no longer think of business or life generally as a zero-sum game. We can no longer afford to. A rising tide raises all ships, from the smallest to the richest. We are here today simply to ask that you make sure the tide will rise. From a narrow point of view, this bill is simply intended to hold corporations accountable to the law, just like the common man on the street. But the broader vision is cooperation. Our own bodies are examples of cooperation on a grand scale. Happiness and survival depend on it. Corporations were originally intended to serve the public good. We want to restore that meaning in its fullest, most beautiful form. I understand further that it's widely reported in business journals that socially responsible mutual funds do better on the bottom line. If you pass this bill, you're legislating increased profits. Our country was founded on the axiom of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, limited only when it interferes with someone else's pursuit of happiness. Senate Bill 843 is simply a restatement of this principle. Business profit is increased, not hindered, by this concept of liberty. By supporting this bill, you strike a blow for liberty and the bottom line. How can you lose? Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Sharon Scott from Salem, Oregon. I am a co-regional rep of the Alliance for Democracy and co-chair of the local Salem chapter. Thank you for having this hearing. As private citizens, we are losing our ability to impact decision-making that affects our daily lives. Large corporations, especially multinationals, are making closed-door decisions which affect our working conditions, our neighborhood environmental quality, our locally owned businesses' existence, and the very education of our children. In our schools, our children are inundated with corporate advertising, regardless of the product's adverse effects. Our family locally owned businesses are evaporating as the multinational corporations unfairly compete with imported products made in slave-like conditions. Our air, water, and very lives are impacted when decisions to increase profits by inadequate environmental protection devices are implemented. And our neighbors' lives are affected by lax monitoring of their working conditions and the subtle and not so subtle harassment if they complain about these working conditions. With Senate Bill 843, we have the opportunity to limit corporations' ability to operate in such a way as to harm the public. We need a law to say no to those corporations which put profits before people. In a democracy, we are supposed to be a government of the people, for the people, and by the people. With this bill, we Oregonians can sustain this most basic and treasured belief. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Any questions? Well, thank you. Thank you for your written statement. Thank you for your presentation. By the way, you folks, when you go north and the Irish is all in bloom, the state shrine is family owned. The Irish shrine is artist garden. So if you, as you know, every year I used to take one of the House members, name each one of you members in the House that I thought of you. I might just do it for the Senate. I got to decide which Irish you get, or just the shrine's going to have to let me have them. And I'm looking at your personality to decide which Irish fits you the best. Senator Toronto.
The best one.
Okay. Okay.
Thanks for the time. Thanks for letting us talk.
You named me in 1995. The Irish he gave me in 1995, which I haven't forgotten to this day, was Storm Center.
Well, okay. Thank you very, very much.
Dark black one like your jacket.
Thank you. Okay. Anyone else here on 843? All right, close the hearing 843.
I'm going to combine three. This is a shiny die of the today's hearing. We'll have a public hearing on Senate Bill 1171, 1175, 1176, and I know I'm early, but... we're done, but so, Constance, oh, you want to? Okay, we just, wait a minute. We did it, but let's, you want to go, hold it. Where am I?
844 is your school safety game.
School safety.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure, come up here. I need you. It's definitely up because nobody's here. I had to do my own bill, so. No, it's my fault. That's great. That's great. I love it. I love it. I got beat up on my bill. You're not going to beat up my bill, are you?
Heavens no.
Thank you.
This one is needed.
I want you to hear this, folks. Now you don't know why I need a bill. Thank you. The public here on 844, Senate Bill 844. Thank you very much. You have to identify yourself, please. Thank you for coming out.
My name is Jim Bingham. I'm an assistant principal at North Salem High School in the Salem Kaiser School District.
That's enough, folks. I told you. If this is north, I'm home of the Vikings.
Oh, the Minnesota Purple People Eater.
No. These are the red and black Vikings. Go ahead.
Right. North Salem High School Principal Mike Kolb, along with his assistant principals and teaching staff, support Senate Bill 844. We see the issue of non-students congregating around a school as one of safety and security. North sits on land surrounded by a public sidewalk where people of questionable character stand, watch, and interact with students. Oftentimes, that interaction turns hostile within moments. We have had instances where gang members come and wait for school to be let out. They park their cars across the street, stand on the sidewalks, and look intimidating. They may flash gang signs, yell out challenging statements, or they may just sit and stare. All this behavior is intended to incite our students. We stand on our side, keeping the peace, but we have no control over the people across the street. Schools are places where undesirable people sometimes go to make a statement. These people can always find the person they are looking for at school. If, for example, an incident happened at the local mall, the schools become the location for revenge. There has been several such situations where we would have to ask the Salem Police Department to send extra cars to patrol the streets around North in a show of force to prevent a serious incident from happening. North Salem High also has halfway houses within eyesight. Just last year, one of our students spotted a man across the street come out of his house with a gun. We immediately went into a lockdown and called the police. The man was a parolee living in a halfway house. The gun turned out to be a BB gun that he was firing in his yard, which was against his terms of parole, and was taken back to jail. We didn't know anything about the house before this incident. We also have registered sex offenders who have walked into our school for no reason other than just to look around, and all we can do is escort the person off our grounds. A law such as this would be of tremendous benefit in keeping our school safe so that we can maintain a positive learning environment.
You see where it came from. It's important testimony. So, Bill, you say maybe you got some language?
Jim, I was a committee. I met outside with Kathy Osborne briefly, and I've been working on some language as we sit here. What we would suggest is that on line 20 after section, add, and if a school employee or law enforcement officer has notified the person that the person's conduct is causing public inconvenience, annoyance, I can't read my own writing, or risk, recklessly creating a risk. That's the language that comes up above.
I would like to point out, Mr. Chairman, of the committee, that the conduct that we've heard about probably would not fall within the statute, because what you have to go back and look at is a disorderly conduct statute, which says making unreasonable noise disturbs on any lawful assembly, obstructs vehicles. And I think the conduct that we've heard about is talking about loitering. And I don't think under Oregon that we can reach that particular conduct. But what this amendment would do is it would allow the school official to go out and tell someone they're disturbing the school. And if they don't leave, then they could be charged with a misdemeanor, a Class A misdemeanor, rather than a Class B misdemeanor. If they're still causing alarm before they even notify them, they could still charge them with a Class B misdemeanor. So what this does is you give notice, and what it would do is it would increase the penalty. It also increases the definition by the use of school safety zone.
So we're trying. We're trying to get constitutional. I really appreciate the hard work. Well, what happens? We held a public hearing and I asked the people who somewhat disagreed with the bill to go out in the hall and work on it. So it's not fair that you don't know that, but that's what's been going on. We've been trying to work the bill. Questions or comments?
Thank you.
Well, thank you for coming over from North.
Thank you.
Good luck in the baseball game today.
Oh, yeah. We've always got something going.
Right, you sure do.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Tell the principal, Mike, I said hello.
I will do.
And Coach Valentini, tell him I said hello, too. I tell everybody in North I said hello. Okay. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 844, and now we go to the final moments that we're here for. I'm going to get in trouble because we're ahead, but we're going to do it. Over the public hearing on Senate Bill 1171, 1175, 1176. Connie, you want to come forward and start this, or whoever. Whoever's there.
Mr. Chair, I'll make some introductory comments as the certified smart people come forward. I'll just make some brief comments about Senate Bill 1171. This bill, put simply, sets up an external review process for when consumers of managed care are either upset or disagree with a managed care's ruling on a health care decision. And it allows an outside third party, to make a decision as to whether the plan should be providing coverage or should not. I noticed that there are not a lot of managed care organizations in the room. That's not because they don't oppose it. They do. It's simply because they don't believe this is moving forward. But frankly, colleagues, I would just say a couple things. One is having the outside third party system in place basically inspires in consumers confidence in the entire system. So it helps consumers, and it actually acts in a win-win for both the managed care organizations and for the consumers. And besides, the voters love this one. On that happy note, I'll turn it over to the very smart panel. And Constance, you think you're going to get away from not testifying, but we are going to make you testify.
I'm going to go first. For the record, I'm Connie Seeley, Research Director for the Senate Democratic Leadership Office. And I don't know if I'm here to offer testimony as much as to answer questions.
Okay.
So I think I'll turn that over to my colleagues at the table.
My name is Elizabeth Byers. I'm here representing a campaign for patients' rights. Within the Oregon Health Action Campaign and Project Equality as well. We support this bill. It's a basic platform that Senate Bill 27, the Patients' Rights Bill, was intended to incorporate this sort of thing. It seems only fair that when you want to dispute a service, you should be able to dispute it outside of the environment where the service is offered and get a fair hearing. So we really encourage you maintaining this bill and sending it where it needs to go to continue through the process. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Sylvia Cayley, and I'm with the Oregon Law Center, which is a nonprofit law firm representing low-income people in civil legal matters statewide, and we wholeheartedly support this bill. We have increasing numbers of clients who have group health plans and individual health plans under a managed care system, and they would very much appreciate having an external review body to which they could take their appeals. And I think this is a step in the right direction for improving consumer confidence in managed care and actually improving delivery of service under managed care. Thank you.
Questions? Sure, absolutely.
Mr. Chair, Connie, the last time I looked for the MCSL tracking service, I think it indicated there were like 9 or 10 states, maybe more than that, that actually had adopted this legislation, or the type of process, this type of procedure. How many actually?
Chair Courtney, Ms. Sweet, there are 20 states that actually have external review legislation, two of which passed in 1999, so just in the past 4 months. And then at my last check, in the last 2 days, there's about 14 others who have legislation pending, and one of those states would be ours, of course.
Other questions? Well, sure, ask Constance. I mean, let's do your thing. This is your moment to shine, Constance.
Oh. Chair Courtney and the committee, a couple comments I guess I would add is Senator Brown, I know, has two articles. I don't know if she distributed them to you. One is the recent Oregonian article just from 2 days ago, and the other is an article from a recent U.S. News and World Report magazine. And what's interesting about that article is it speaks to how the industry is actually starting to embrace external review. That in Texas, where it is working its way to the court, the insurance company involved in that case, Aetna, is actually allowing the process of external review to take place. They have the option, because they're finding it in the courts, to have an injunction, but they're finding actually that it's working out in their favor as much as it's working against them, and it's actually helped keep cases from the courts. They're using it as a way to not have these situations go to the courts, as we're hearing about legislation with very high dollar amounts attached to them. So I would bring that to your attention.
Thank you. Other questions or comments? Thank you very much. Now, excuse me, there's someone in the audience. Are you here for a bill? Just watching what's happening. Well, I don't know what that means. Thank you very much. That's going to do it. I wonder if anybody else is coming on.
Mr. Chair, I could speak briefly about Senate Bill 1175. But I got to sneeze.
Okay, well, just hold for a minute while we can breathe.
Sure, I can. Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 1175.
Will you going to testify? Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1175 allows the health plan to authorize specialized to service primary care physicians for certain enrollees. And my understanding of this bill is that, for example, they could designate the ophthalmologist, which happens to be the eye doctor, as a primary care provider, so that when, for example, Constance has something wrong with her eye, she can directly contact her ophthalmologist without messing around during session to find a doctor that would refer her to an ophthalmologist. We passed a similar bill in 1997. It was Stanton's bill, but I do not recall the bill number, that would allow OBGYNs, obstetricians, gynecologists, to be declared primary care providers, so would that women in particular. It wasn't Senate Bill 152, it was Senate Bill 814. Mm-hmm. That would allow OBGYNs to be declared primary care providers if they took appropriate steps, so that women who primarily use OBGYNs would not have to see other doctors in order to get to their OBGYN. So that's all I know about that one.
Chair Courtney and the committee, Connie Seeley, Senate Democratic Office of Record. That's true. My understanding is that this is most often used with
people who have a chronic condition, whether it be diabetes or a respiratory situation where it's an ongoing health situation, and instead of going through a primary care physician every time you need to see a doctor, you're allowed to access your specialist in those situations.
So it's really specific in that it does offer this procedure, process for enrollees who have chronic disabling or life-threatening illnesses. There is another Senate bill, though, that specifically relates to exactly this that you spoke of, that has been heard and worked on, I think, by the Senate Health and Human Services Committee, that deals specifically with ophthalmology access.
Any further questions or comments? Thank you very much. We close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1171, 1175, 1176. Any other business to come before this committee today?
No.
I do want to thank you, Senator Tarnow, Senator Brown. I want to thank you, Dan Quinn, and Judy, for coming out here today to do what we did. I think, you know, it's a... It was an interesting experience. I hope you thought it was worthwhile.
Yes. This is great. Thank you, Peter.
We're now adjourned.
So that's what you're moving out here.
Mm-hmm.